Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Museum of Science, where you can experience the heart of New England, their new giant screen film showcasing this iconic region. You can see it now on the IMAX Dome screen. Tickets at mos.org.
And the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads, featuring illuminated manuscripts, metalwork, carvings, and works by contemporary Ethiopian artists, on view now. For tickets and more information, you can visit pem.org.
I'm Jim Browdy, head on Boston Public Radio. We're live at the Boston Public Library today, starting off by talking about the execution of three more school children and three adults at a Nashville school. Apparently, the pro-gun extremists think that drag queens are a grave threat, but AR-style weapons are not. We'll be opening phone and text lines to get your reaction.
I'm Marjorie Egan. Then Patriots owner Robert Kraft, despite some dismal seasons, says he still believes in Coach Belichick and his ability to return the Patriots to their former glory. We'll get Trenny Casey from NBC Sports Boston to weigh in on that, plus this weekend's men and women's Final Four in college basketball. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday and every Friday from the Boston Public Library, and we are streaming both on YouTube and Facebook, facebook.com/GBHnews and youtube.com/GBHnews. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there. By the way, the first text I think is for you. Hello, I am interested in two tickets for the March 31st Browdy Egan show. How do I go about it? Thank you. Could you answer that text there?
Well, I think they're very close, right? But They don't need tickets to the Browdy Egan show. They can just show up. It is free. Stay as little or as long as you like. Just walk into the Boston Public Library and hang out with us for as long as you want to.
By the way, Elizabeth Warren is with us tomorrow. Today, we are processing yet another mass shooting in America at a Christian elementary school in Nashville. Left three students and three adults dead. Let me just read their names if I can. The adults are Cynthia Peake, Catherine Kuntz, and Mike Hill. And all nine-year-olds, the three kids, Evelyn Diekhaus, Haley Scruggs, and William Kinney. The sheer number of mass shootings in the country is staggering. The Gun Violence Archive has counted at least 130 mass shootings this year alone. We're guessing we are feeling much like you are this morning, grappling with a profound sense of anger, of hopelessness, of confusion. Why do we as a nation accept this as part of our lives, and why won't our lawmakers do anything to change things? While some Republicans wear AR-15 pins in their lapels and pontificate over the dangerousness of, I don't know, drag queen story hour and the Statue of David, apparently, they don't think AR-15s are threatening to kids at all. We've talked before about how maybe, just maybe, being shown the gruesome effects these weapons have on the body of a child might move the needle. The Washington Post came close with a piece today showing the graphic impact of AR-15s with the consent of some parents from Sandy Hook and Parkland. Should we go even farther, though, again, with the consent of the parents and do what Mamie Till did, showing the body in an open casket of her 14-year-old son, Emmett Till? She said, "I wanted the world to see what they did to my baby." If these legislators saw what these AR weapons were doing to the babies of so many Americans, would that change anything? Will anything change anything? 877-301 to call us or text. Let me just read one paragraph from this Washington Post thing. And by the way, the graphics are much more impressive than the words. AR-15 fire bullets at such a high velocity, often a barrage of 30 or even 100 in rapid succession. It can eviscerate multiple people in seconds. A single bullet lands with a shockwave intense enough to blow apart a skull, demolish vital organs. The impact is even more acute on the compact body of a small child. It literally can pulverize bones. It can shatter your liver. It can provide this blast effect. You and I have been talking about this both in situations of war, and I guess this is war at home, about if a parent said yes, and we actually saw the you know, Julia Kim has said repeatedly, you can't even recognize a child who has been shot by an AR-15. Do you think that would change the minds of some of these pathetic, cowardly, owned by gun manufacturer legislature?
Well, I don't know. Maybe what we should do is every time one of these creepy people starts talking about getting rid of drag queens and shows a picture of a drag queen reading books at a story hour, like it's some kind of outrage, they should juxtapose that with a picture of the body of a child that is pulverized by these guns. And you know, at some point, it becomes whose rights matter more? People who want to go out and buy AR-15s for whatever reason they want to buy them, and so high-capacity magazines, which enable you to shoot and kill so many people so fast, or the rights of millions of parents and millions of children who now are having to have active shooter drills in school, who now are worried about they drop their child off at school in the morning, and thank God it's still in the minority. It doesn't happen. Your chances, if you want to look at odds, are that your school is not going to be hit. But there's an underlying fear all the time about, am I going to see my child at the end of the day? Are their rights worth more than the nagging fear you feel?
Because they won't answer that question, Marjorie, because their position is guns have nothing to do with it. But if you were listening the other day, this brilliant piece in the Texas Tribune quoted some of the 400 cowardly cops from Uvalde who waited an hour for a SWAT team to come from 60 miles away. Why? Because they were scared of the AR-15 that was being carried by the shooter.
That's
it seems to me that argument, because not that it had any weight before, has been completely eviscerated by the cops' own pronouncements post-Uvalde.
And you know what else? There's becoming like a 6 degrees of separation in these shootings, too. We have some sound from this woman, Ashby Beasley.
This is incredible.
Who, now listen to this. She survived that July 4th massacre at the Highland Park, the parade
in
Illinois.
Yeah.
She happened to be in Nashville to visit on a family trip in Nashville, Tennessee, on a family trip Monday. And you know why she was there?
No, I don't.
She was there. Part of the reason she was there, because she was going to have lunch with a friend of hers whose son was killed in a mass shooting at a Waffle House in Tennessee 5 years ago. So her friend had lost a child at a Waffle House. But the friend called her to postpone the lunch because her second surviving kid was in lockdown in a Nashville school because of the shooting. So here's Ashley Beasley talking about this school shooting yesterday, interrupting a Fox News reporter to call for change.
Aren't you guys tired of covering this? Aren't you guys tired of being here and having to cover all of these mass shootings? I have been lobbying in D.C. since we survived a mass shooting in July. I have met with over 130 lawmakers. How is this still happening? How are our children still dying, and why are we failing them?
Good for her. So, Marjorie, we've talked ad nauseum, you and I, about the demonstrations that were successful in Israel in response to Netanyahu trying to take over the judicial system. We've talked about the unending, relentless demonstrations in France over the unilateral raising of the retirement age from 62 to 64 by Macron. What if it turned out people had the exact same reaction here in the streets of this country until Republicans in Congress and a few holdout Democrats decided to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines?
Well, we have, and this has all happened in my adult lifetime, when we used to have very normal Republicans, very normal Democrats, few people on the fringe on either side. We basically have a Republican Party that's lost its marbles, that's opposed to almost everything that people want, like reasonable background checks, like reasonable gun control, like reasonable health insurance, like reasonable curbs on climate initiatives. They're on the wrong side of all these issues because of money interests or just their own political ambition. So I think you have to keep calling out the people that are causing this. I mean, John Cornyn, you know, actually he's the Texas senator, and he was involved in that. They did get, after Uvalde, they did get the red flag law strengthened. That allows people, of course, to take away temporarily, just temporarily, firearms for people who believe to be a danger. He basically said, we've gone as far as we can go. What is he talking about? We did have an assault weapons ban during the 90s. Remember,
we did.
And what we need is what Biden keeps talking about, is we need an assault weapons ban. Listen to this text from Amber in Worcester. When is enough going to be enough? I am married to a combat veteran who agrees that no civilian needs access to an assault firearm. They're not made to defend. They're made to kill and kill effectively. And as you just said, they're basically made to pulverize people, and we're pulverizing kids.
877-301-8970. Whatever observations you have on Nashville, if you want to comment on the notion about showing the bodies, assuming the parents said yes, of these young kids after their bodies are pulverized, should we have mass demonstrations? Not one-day demonstrations, but mass demonstrations a la Israel, a la France. What should we do if you are troubled by the carnage in schools and everywhere else in this country? Ishmael in Milton, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. Long-time listener, second-time
Thank
caller.
You. Thank you.
But, regarding the picture, you know, my views changed after Sandy Hook, right? I was so shook up from Sandy Hook. I really thought that something was going to happen.
So do we all.
And nothing happened. So if we show pictures, we will get, of course, we will have that visceral reaction. And then we'll become numb to it. And so I don't think that much is going to change. You know, unfortunately, it's when things affect us personally that we make changes. It's not when we see news that has happened, you know, in Tennessee or Texas or somewhere else. When it comes home and hits home, then, then that community decides.
Well, with all due respect, Ishmael, sometimes it hits home literally and figuratively, and it does move people. Remember Steve Scalia? Is he the number two ranking Republican in the House?
I think so.
I think number two. Was shot at that baseball game in Washington, came back, people naively assume, including me, that he may get some level of religion on guns. In fact, he just got more baked in. So, you know.
That's what I was exactly thinking about while I was waiting.
Yeah.
And what I said to myself is, he's a politician. Their number one job is to get elected. Their
exactly.
Number one job is to get reelected. So I don't think that, you know, it's going to affect him. He would rather pass away, unfortunately, than to lose his seat. So, we are not going to have, this is not going to come from the politicians in Washington. It has to come, I think, as you were saying about the protests, there has to be a mass protest from these communities, you know, down south. Us up here in the Northeast are not going to make the difference. We're not going to make the changes. It has to come from those communities down south.
Well, let me disagree. John Rosenthal, head of Stop Handgun Violence, who's a Massachusetts-based real estate developer, has had a huge impact on gun reform, not just here, but beyond our borders. I mean, the reality is you can always do more, and I think it's fine to have it heard from a state that has pretty tough gun laws, too. Ishmael, thank you for your thoughts. We appreciate it.
Here's the text. So I think people in this country need to see the carnage. If we're going to live like this, we need to know the consequences. Congress insulates themselves from the reality of their decisions with the lobbies, and someone with courage needs to break norms and show what is actually happening to regular good people.
Isn't there a consensus that seeing Emmett Till being totally unrecognizable began the change? The world because of the courage of his mother?
Yeah, well, I think so. I mean, it was incredible that she did that and allowed a magazine to take pictures of him and allowed all those thousands of people who came and saw his body to see what, as she put it, they had done to her son.
Her baby.
Ellen in New Hampshire, thank you for calling.
Hey, Ellen.
Hey, thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
You know, I am so disgusted by this. Nobody should have a weapons of war. They should not be able to get them. But I still have a kid in school. She's in high school. And I'm going to tell you, it's not that these kids don't think about this, because they have had things happen where they've all had to run for their life when she was in middle school. It wasn't real, but it happened, and the kids were actually, some kids were throwing up. It was terrible. But I would actually spend every penny. I would go homeless. If something like that happened to my kid, I would buy every billboard and rent every available space and put what my child looked like before and what my child looked like afterwards, because you can't recognize these kids. And we have got to make it a priority that we do not elect people who can be bought.
Well, you know, you elect a lot of people. I'm not directing this at you, but your fellow New Hampshireites elect a lot of people that allow a certain weaponry to be sold in New Hampshire that makes its way into Massachusetts. And you talk to a police commissioner in Boston, a huge percentage of the killing weapons that are used here were bought in states like New Hampshire. So, you know, it's just...
I agree.
I know you, I'm sure
I
you
agree.
Do.
And I think that there should be bringing it over a line. When you buy in a state like here and then you bring it over another state's line, if you get caught, you should be highly imposed some type of, you know, some type of fine for doing that. You know, because as far as I'm concerned, that's gun running.
Hey, Ellen, thanks for the call. You know what's interesting, by the way, about what how a moderate is described? How is Governor Sununu, if he enters the presidential race, seen as a moderate, right? And he presides over a state where essentially it's a free-for-all when it comes to weapons. I know you've told remind people who are new to our show, when John Rosenthal took you to that gun show in New Hampshire and you asked to purchase a specific item,
it was right after Sandy Hook, and
I
they had the Bushmaster guns, where that was one that was used in, if I got that right, that was used in Sandy Hook. So I wondered if you could get one up there. And people say, oh, you know, you have to go through these checks and stuff. Well, no, you don't. You just can go up there, and I think they were selling at the time for $500. And if I had $500, I could have bought one of those guns and take it home with me and shot people.
Didn't
up.
You ask the gun seller
high capacity magazines?
Did you say it's illegal in my home state? What did he say to you?
He said, just don't get stopped by the state cops coming across the border to Massachusetts. And I think that the high capacity magazine is just some plastic thing. I think it was only like $20 or $30, but it enables you to shoot all these people really, really quickly. And you know, it's a whole weird atmosphere up there. Not only do they have guns and ammunition and high capacity magazines, but they have all this Nazi paraphernalia and all these swastikas all over the place. And you think, what is wrong with people? And it's always interesting to me how many veterans who've served and learned about guns and used guns are absolutely anti-guns as killing machines, which is all these things are. You don't need them to protect you in your house. You don't need them to go to the firing range. You don't need them to shoot animals. They've just become the weapon of choice of mass murderers.
Well, you know, it's not just veterans. How about, you know, remember when the Republican Party used to love cops before January 6th, law enforcement
people? Cops don't like them either.
Cops don't like them either.
Exactly.
Cops want this stuff banned, and obviously that's one area where they think the cops are full of it because it's going to stop the flow of money from the gun manufacturers.
Matt in the car, thank you for calling.
Hey, Matt.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me on.
Sure.
I honestly don't even know where to begin. If I get a little excited, one of you feel free to cut me off.
Go right.
That's okay.
I absolutely agree. I don't know if it'll change anything. Show the pictures to them. At the very least, it'll if they still don't budge after that, it'll expose them as being somebody who can look at these pictures somehow and then continue to do nothing about the situation. I work with children for a living. I work in two settings that seem to be primary targets for these shootings, schools, and I work in a church. Mm. And when I'm not actively doing something, I find myself sitting there wondering, what do I do if I hear gunshots?
Yeah.
Where do I go? Do I try to save somebody first? Do I try to block a door? What windows can we break to get out of here? You know, I'm actively thinking about this almost every single day of my life. And when these shootings happen, I find myself Marjorie, you bring up the point of these parents not being able to identify their children.
Yeah.
Because I picture my students. I worked with some of my students. I've known some of my students 8, 9, 10 years. I've become very close to them and their families. And I cannot imagine, when I picture that, I can't help myself picturing that happening to my students. And it's just beyond upsetting. And I don't know what else can be done about it. And I feel like I'm only 35 years old. And I feel like in my lifetime that nothing's going to be done about this. And I'm on to the next point about I know a decent number of people who I've gone to school with and gotten to know over the years who've been in combat, who've been in Iraq and Afghanistan, who are vocal about the same. They're against these weapons as well. And I don't understand how so many people in police, like you said, are against these weapons as well. I don't understand how many groups of people who use these types of weapons for a living who are vocally opposed to citizens being able to own them. I don't understand who else has to speak up.
The answer is these politicians don't care because, as an earlier caller said, all they care about, all they stand for is re-election. And as long as the money is pouring in from that appropriate place, they're going to be where they are. Matt, that was a terrific call.
Well,
can I just respond?
A lot of places are very gerrymandered, too. A lot of these legislatures around the country are very gerrymandered.
Yeah, they are.
And
not
so
Senate seats aren't not gerrymandered,
Senate
obviously.
Senate seats are not, but it almost seems there has to be some kind of mass. I don't know what to do about it. I really
make
don't
their
know
lives miserable. Make them uncomfortable in their lives, even if their seat is not at risk. Everywhere they go, let them know what how their constituents feel. Here is a person. There are a number of people sending the same text. This isn't a sign. Stop equating drag queen story hour with mass shooting tragedies. Just stop.
We're not.
We're not. They are. Well, actually, they are not. What we are trying to say, and we'd love you to call, by the way, at 877-301-8970, any of the people who are sending these kind of texts, is they have decided that drag queen story hours are a threat to the health and safety of children, and they're being outlawed in lots of states, or at minimum, trashed by elected officials.
Or going after gay rights. They're going after gay rights.
Right,
they're going after women's rights. Yeah.
These same people don't consider AR-15s to be a threat to kids. And if they did, the assumption is that they would do something. So with all due respect, we're not going to stop. And if you want to advocate your position, we would love you to call us on the phone.
Well, the point is that firearms are now the leading cause of death of children in the United States of America. Guns are the leading cause of death of children. Not car accidents, not any kind of disease. It's guns. So that's kind of the ridiculous irony. They're talking about we want to protect the children, protect the children, protect the children. Well, you don't want to protect the children because the thing that's killing them, you're doing nothing about except loosening the laws. So many of these states are making, like Tennessee, are making it even less difficult to get a gun.
So we got to take a break. Before we do, I don't know if I asked you this the other day, but my apologies. If John Cornyn, Texas senator, were standing here and
he got booed.
And
remember?
We read him. I do. He's still elected. And we read him, or Ted Cruz, we read him what cops in his own state, 400 Uvalde cops or cops from the area, said they didn't go in and protect those kids for 60 minutes till it was too late because they were scared of the weapon. What would he say as a guy, both of them are, Cruz and Cornyn, who say it's not about the gun? It's not. It's nothing. What would they
well,
say?
It's getting a little bit harder to say it's about mental health because they don't do anything about mental health
either.
And as many people have pointed out, people have mental health issues all around the world. There's only one place that
exactly
has this kind of killing, and it's because we have such easy access to guns. Anyway, we're talking about something that's sadly become a frequent topic because we've had how many mass shootings have we had?
130 this year.
130
at least.
This year, and I think 60 some children have already been killed. And it's only March. So anyway, we're taking your calls and texts at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We're broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library, and we are streaming live on YouTube and Facebook. YouTube.com/GBH News and Facebook.com/GBH News.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're live at the library, streaming online at Facebook.com/GBH News and YouTube.com/GBH News. Tomorrow we are joined by Senator Elizabeth Warren. We'll obviously talk to her about it. We're talking about the Nashville execution, 6 people, 3 kids, 9 years old, 3 adults murdered there, how nothing happens, about whether or not we should at least invite parents to emulate what Mamie Till said when she left the casket open on her unrecognizable 14-year-old son, Emmett, saying, I wanted the world to see what they did to my baby. Would that change anything? Would mass demonstrations change anything? This is interesting how you have to live. I'm a high school parent, and when we hear more sirens than usual, a friend and I text each other to determine if it's heading to the high school. That's a nice way to live, isn't it?
Well, I think that you hear this constantly from parents, right, that their own children are worried about. I mean, we have to have active shooter drills for 5-year-olds in kindergarten. I mean, that's what people's right, so-called, to buy these weapons is meaning for the mental health of young children. And, you know, we talk about the kids in a mental health crisis, well, how am I going to worry about getting shot in school? It's something that might make you nervous a lot of the time, even if you are the most level-headed kid going, not to mention the climate issues and all those other issues. Listen to this text. George W. Bush was able to initiate a 20-year war against Iraq on the suspicion that there were weapons of mass destruction, says Joseph from Boston. Well, we actually have weapons of mass destruction right here in this country that are in use daily, killing innocent children and adults. There will always be anger and unresolved mental illness. This is not, and he says the same thing I just said, that we're the only country in the world that has shootings like this. So it's not the mental illness, it's the guns.
You know, by the way, I want to remind people again, every opportunity we have to talk about how important a presidential election is because of his power, like Trump, to pick three nominees and ultimately confirm justice in the Supreme Court. Even when the Supreme Court was not nearly as extreme as it is now, one vote decided that the Second Amendment gave individuals the right to own weapons for their own protection, in clear contravention, I would argue, to the actual language of the Second Amendment. One vote different on the Supreme Court, and this country might be different. Where do you want to go?
Let's go to Bill in Chelmsford. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Two quick points. Well, first one, to tie in what your discussion was yesterday, why an awful lot of young people don't want to have children today. Mm. They have a government that just doesn't care about the safety of children. I was a firefighter EMT for 35 years. In the last 10 years of my career, prior to my retirement, we saw the implementation of bulletproof vests on our trucks and helmets so that we could accompany the police into these school shooting situations. We trained for it. And the thing is, I have a daughter still in high school. I got two in college. And unfortunately, I'm in that same boat with that recent text you got. You hear the sirens, I have a scanner, and I listen. Oh. And it's always brought to mind, and what a terrible way to live for our whole country. And my final comment is this. I would love to be able to force the senators and representatives to sit there and look at these, but they won't do it. The ones that are against this are adamant. You say it. They want to get reelected. They play up to their base. And they will not watch these videos, and they'll constantly blame it on something else. And it's clear that if you can't get the weapon, you can't do the crime. And it's very emotional for so many of us.
Well, you said
Bill,
it beautifully,
thank you.
Bill. Thank you for the call.
Call. We have someone from Marlboro. I think it's Emil from Marlboro, who just took a trip to Florida and saw a powerful meme there last month. Here it is. We thank our school children who gave their lives to support our right to bear arms.
Are you kidding me? That is unbelievable. That is unbelievable.
Yeah. Jackie from Chelmsford, wow. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi, guys. Long time no speak.
Oh, Jackie, how are you? It's really good to hear your voice.
Oh, it's great to hear you guys. We need to stop naming the shooters. Stop giving them a name. Stop giving them a face on the news. Have this be shooter 283 and not attack anything that glorifies them or acknowledges them in any way other than the murderers that they are. We have absolute training for driving, for drivers. Listen, I'm a responsible gun owner. My training I take and continue to take as a responsible gun owner is, it costs me much more than the singular pistol that I own for self-protection as a woman on my own, but I take training all the time. We need to force people, you have to train. If you're going to own a gun, you have to go through ABCD courses in order to do that, and we don't have that either.
Jackie, why'd you get a gun when you first did?
I work in an industry where I have I work in an industry that requires a permit.
Okay.
And I also, Jim, I joined your tribe and I converted years ago. And the Chelmsford Police gave our synagogue active shooter training. I'm on the security committee. I didn't get it for that, but I got it because it became necessary for me.
Jackie, we haven't heard your voice in a long time. We're glad you called, and thanks very much. Stay in touch.
Listen to this one from Joe in South Yarmouth. You guys, meaning you and me, are such liberal loonies. Wayne LaPierre and the NRA care about life. That's why they tend to condemn the destruction of innocent life through abortion.
That's a good one. Let's take one more, and then we'll move on for at least for today. Lowell in Providence, welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to address the fact that, you know, that this is a right, and many people are being fed into the idea that if this right is taken away, their ability to live safely is taken away. Mm-hmm. And as they portray life in America on the news as so dangerous, and the amount of crime, and that even protesting is a crime, and that people may stop you on the streets and take your car, or, you know, it's we live in a world of fear. And I don't, some of us can live without guns, and there's this percentage of the country that feel they cannot live without a gun.
Well, you know what I say to them, Lowell? I say to them, if you need to have a gun, you do have a constitutional right to have it. You shouldn't Absolutely. Have a constitutional right to have an AR-15. Can we agree on that?
Absolutely.
Well, that's...
I think there should be a limit on how many guns you can own. I don't. If you can't hold 17 guns on your person, why can you own 17 guns?
Well, Lowell, that reminds me of one of my favorite and least favorite stories, but we'll end this. You know the story
Deval
I'm going to tell?
Deval Patrick.
Yeah. Deval Patrick was not exactly a pro-gun guy. He's the governor in the most liberal state in America. He filed a piece of gun control legislation, obviously, when he was governor, which would have limited the purchase of weapons to one a month. And I couldn't believe it, but it spoke to the fact that even here, and he did what was the art of the possible.
12 guns a year.
He didn't know what he could get through the legislature. It was not because he was dying to have people have another dozen guns to add to their collection. But even here, he was concerned about what he could get through this all-Democratic legislature to his desk. So
People went crazy over it.
It didn't pass.
12 guns a year was not enough.
Not enough, apparently.
I guess you got to have 36 guns in 3 years, and what's another 36 in another 3 years?
72,
thank you. And the shooter in this case apparently had other guns at their home as well.
Yeah.
That tends to be a thing where people have like lots and lots of guns. But we are moving on.
We'll get back to this as the days go ahead, and we hope you'll stay focused on it too.
Coming up, we're going to talk to NBC Sports Trini Casey. We're going to talk to her about the Final Four, Bill Belichick proclaiming his greatness, and Bob Kraft's efforts to combat anti-Semitism. That's all next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. We're live at the library, streaming online at facebook.com/GBH News and youtube.com/GBH News. And Elizabeth Warren, as the Senator Elizabeth Warren, who announced yesterday she's running for a third term, will be joining us tomorrow. Now for a little bit of a change of pace, which we need. We're joined at the library by Trini Casey, anchor and reporter for NBC Sports Boston. Hello there, Trini.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Can I submit a question to Elizabeth Warren that I just submitted to you and Jim?
Oh, uh-huh. Yes.
Ask her how someone who cares about gun violence living in a state like Massachusetts, where our legislators do vote in the way that we want them to vote, how do you impact change? Like, if we march in the streets here, what happens? Like, what would she suggest and how we can actually enact change?
Well, I told you, there is a piece of legislation that I believe is pending on Beacon Hill, which would be a great model, which would require that or mandate that you cannot manufacture a weapon within our borders that couldn't be owned within our borders. For example, we have an assault weapons ban,
yep.
And Smith & Wesson is reportedly moving to where?
I think they're moving
to Tennessee or something.
I'm not sure. But
because of that, but I think that'd be a great model for a lot of bluish kinds of states.
Okay.
Not to mention the fact if there were mass demonstrations here, even if it's only Massachusetts, they'd be on the news.
Well, so I will contact my local legislators and let them know.
Good.
So let's talk about some basketball here. Caitlin Clark has turned out to be a massive, she's described in this piece from on the NCAA Women's Tournament as the greatest artist in college basketball. She's with Iowa. I guess they're still in the running,
they're
right?
The
they are. They're
four,
in the
yeah.
Final Four.
And we've got some coverage of her on ESPN making this three-pointer against Louisville yesterday.
Here's Clark, guarded by Robinson. Clark firing again. Oh, my!
Oh, my.
Caitlin Clark, a showstopper.
Did you see her line? 41 points. What was it? 12 rebounds and 10 assists.
The first ever triple-double in NCAA tournament history. Not in men's or women's.
Wait,
the
there's
first,
never been a triple-double?
There's never been a triple-double in NCAA tournament history.
Double-digit rebounds, assists, and points.
And points. Wow. So she had 41 points, 12 rebounds, 10 assists.
So she's a superstar.
Yes.
I watched videos of her last night.
Unbelievable.
She's only 6 feet tall, too. I mean,
only 6 feet tall.
Well,
that is tall for a girl.
Well, even
a,
in women, yeah. A lot of women
but she's
are
a guard.
In the high sixes.
Well,
but
she's a guard. A lot of guards are a little smaller, 5'7" to 5'10". So, and she has this like really fun, infectious personality. Like, she's really goofy. And I thought it was great. So after Iowa advanced, when she went, this is what I like about her the most. She has so much confidence. When she was, she could have gone anywhere. She could have played like Iowa. I mean, even I don't follow women's college basketball that closely, so this is something that I learned. But even, you know, Iowa isn't like, it's not a top tier program, right? It's not your Tennessee, your UConn, your South Carolina, your Notre Dame, Stanford, those types of programs. But she stayed in state. She's from West Des Moines, and she stayed at Iowa. And when she accepted and said she was going to go to school there, she said, I'm going to go there, and I'm going to take them to the Final Four. They had
not been,
I think, in like 30 or 35 years. And their head coach is great. She's won like 853 games, which she's never gotten to the promised land. And Caitlin Clark is like carrying this team on her shoulders, and her family was there, and she like chucked the ball to her family after they
take the ball and run out of the
stadium. She said, because otherwise the NCAA is going to try to steal it. And I want it for myself so that I have this like memento for what I did. But I have to say, like, it still isn't quite the coverage that the men's tournament gets.
It's not.
There's not like the pregame shows and the postgame shows and all of this stuff in the same way, like for the men, but women's basketball is getting a lot more attention this time around, this March, than I think they ever have before.
Well, we learned that Tom Brady is acquiring ownership stake in the WNBA, so maybe Caitlin Clark, Tom Brady, and some of these other young great athletes can like change things around.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I how I feel about Tom Brady. I'm a little hot and cold on him because sometimes I think he's a bit of a weirdo. But I love that he has invested in the Las Vegas Aces. Now, okay, go with a front runner, Tom Brady. They just won the WNBA championship this year. But I love what he said. I don't know if you guys happen to see this. And I think it was gone already, so I wasn't able to send it because he put it up on his Instagram stories. But Tom Brady did like an Instagram story and said that the reason he wanted to invest is because he believes in women's sports.
Because of his three sisters.
He has three sisters. Yeah. He like went and watched women's basketball and softball growing up. His niece, I believe, is a top-tier, highly recruited player who's either is at UCLA right now or about to go to UCLA to play softball. So he comes from a really family of like very athletic women.
Yeah.
I just think it's really important for big-time male athletes to invest in women's sports because, and I hate that this is the case, but I think it legitimizes them a little bit more. And having his money, his backing, his voice, like, it draws attention to the sport. And if that's the way that we have to get there,
people
just get eyeballs there,
right?
We'll
watch the games just to see him sitting in the stands.
Yeah.
By the way, we should do a shout-out for a woman down the street who invested a ton of dough. We don't know how much in the WNBA, too.
Linda Henry.
Linda Pizzuti-Henry.
Investor. That's a big deal. And Tom Brady's daughter, I think, is almost 6 feet tall, and she's only about 9.
Vivian.
So can we spend only a minute on the men's Final Four? I have to say, a lot of people, and I think I would have felt this way years ago, really excited because three of the four teams had never been to the Final Four, which is sort of exciting. The problem for me is when I was younger, and I don't mean like 80 years ago. I mean like even 20 years ago, all these players played 2, 3, 4 years, you got to know who college players were, and you had favorites, which is a huge part of this. I've never heard of any of these players because the best players generally do one and done. They play a year, and then they go pro.
So
wasn't Tatum a one-year Duke guy?
Tatum wasn't a one-year Duke guy. But, like, I also think that for schools like the ones we're watching, and even I would even put UConn in this camp, the one-and-done players tend to go to Kansas, Kentucky, Duke, sometimes UCLA – maybe some of the SEC schools, like your Power Five conferences. You know, these teams like San Diego State University, like I don't know many kids that are going to be one and done at San Diego State.
If they're a huge star in the Final Four, they might be.
Maybe, but I mean, even this, I think it's a different type of basketball, some of these lower seeded teams. Like a kid, like the kid at Alabama who was involved, like provided the gun.
Yeah, I know.
I was rooting hard against Alabama. I was happy that they went out early.
Provided
the gun that killed a woman. Yes, yeah. And we'll get into that. We suppose we could have gotten into that at a different time.
And he's a player for Alabama?
He's a player for Alabama, yeah. And his coach, like, brushed it off. He's a top player. He's one of their best players.
And for a top-ranked team, too, which lost. So, yeah.
Has he been charged with a crime?
Not yet. We'll see. We'll see if they cover it up for him down there in Alabama, because we know how they like to treat their superstar athletes.
Yeah.
But even at, like, the University of Miami, like, football is it at the University of Miami. Like, basketball is kind of secondary. Like, Miami, San Diego State, and Florida Atlantic University, like, guys aren't going one and done at FAU, right? Like, even if they're a good player, most of them, quite frankly, probably aren't good enough to be one and done in college. And even at North Carolina, a team that was supposed to be really good this year, like, two of their best players are coming back. So I do think there is a little bit of a trend, and I do think that I have mixed feelings about name, image, and likeness, and the ability for players to make money at the college level. But their ability to monetize their stardom while they are in college does give them more latitude to stay in college, have that experience, stay longer. Because the reason a lot of these kids are one and done is because, you know, a kid like Jason Tatum will tell you, he didn't come from much, and he now supports, you know, his family.
Well, remember those stories about how kids would be in the NCAA finals and their parents couldn't afford to come see them play? And meanwhile, these colleges are making millions of dollars off their
talents.
Well,
a more important story was Derrick Jackson's brackets, when Derrick Jackson used to be at the Globe and would do the brackets not based upon records of the 64 teams, but based upon graduation rate.
Yeah.
And that was pretty powerful stuff, because some of these kids don't make the pros. Can we do? Can we move?
Can we talk really quickly about how much I want UConn to win? Because
I bet on them.
I put money on them at plus 850 when they were
at the beginning of the tournament.
I put money on them. Like, I think after the second round, so as we got into the Sweet 16, I was like, oh man, a lot of big teams are getting knocked out. UConn's always there. I was like, plus 850. That's good money right there.
Are you
there.
Being paid by DraftKings or what's the deal? You should
but
be.
But hey, DraftKings or FanDuel, I'm available.
So Bill Belichick, you know, I am, as you know, I'm really invested in the Belichick versus Brady, was a thing. And you know where I stand. Here's Belichick yesterday at the NFL owners meeting answering a question about what message he might say to his fans. Here's the reporter and then Belichick.
But why they should be optimistic.
Here it is. Well, you'll hear.
What would you say to them to give them a reason to be optimistic for what's ahead for the Patriots?
The last 25 years?
You know, let me just say something.
I don't want to say major blood boil because there's more important things.
So he can't just answer the question.
By the way, I thought of you the entire time I was watching that press conference yesterday. I was like, Jim is losing his mind if he's watching this right now because he's such a jerk to everyone.
Why doesn't, by the way, I'm not saying I don't have the courage to do it. So believe me, a lot of sports reporters, not you, are sycophantic when it comes to these big shots, and they're cowed by the incredible rudeness of Bill Belichick. Why didn't someone say to him afterwards, well, for 20 of those years, you had the greatest quarterback in history. You don't have him anymore. How about that, Mr. Belichick?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is hard. So we were laughing yesterday. So the person who asked that question is Mike Reese.
He's a great reporter, actually.
Great reporter, wonderful, the kindest man, like just a really great human being. But he has started to press Bill more and ask him more, tougher questions. He's not throwing little softballs at him anymore. And now Bill answers him like this. Bill used to give him actual answers with words. And he doesn't do
words.
That. He doesn't. And we were all remarking on that yesterday. We were watching it. We're like, remember when he used to like Mike Reese before Mike Reese pushed him and challenged him a little bit on things? But now Mike. And so I do think that if you cover the Patriots, you're caught a little bit between a rock and a hard place, because you have to go down there every week and you have to talk to Bill Belichick three times a week. And so if you're only getting one word answers, like Phil Perry is another guy who's on our
he's
staff.
He's your colleague, right?
He's amazing. He's so great. And he used to get these long answers from Bill Belichick, like the history of football. And now He gets one worded by him. And I was like, oh, what'd you do, Phil? What'd you ask? What'd you write that ticked him off? And then he boxes you out. It's a really, I do not envy those guys who have to go down there and the women.
I know it's tough.
Like
it
Karen Garigian pushed him.
She's Karen Garigian is great.
The Boston Herald pushed him yesterday on, you know, he was asked about Mac Jones versus Bailey Zappi. Would there be a quarterback controversy again? And she did. She followed up and pushed him a little bit. Mike Reese, Tom Curran, those guys push him from time to time. But again, it's a, you got to walk. Greg Bedard. Greg Bedard is the one who asked him whether or not Boston Sports Journal, whether or not he asked Robert Kraft yesterday whether or not Bill's job would be in jeopardy if they have another losing season. And Robert Kraft, to his credit, oh, there's another thing I don't know if you heard that I want to tell you about Robert Kraft. Robert Kraft, to his credit, kind of hesitated and said, well, listen, our players, because he also asked about the Don Shula record. So Bill Belichick is a handful of wins shy of reaching and then surpassing Don Shula.
Was it
for
19 wins or something?
Yes, I think it is. For most wins all time as an NFL head coach. And Kraft, to his credit, said, our players, we don't emphasize stats with our players, and we don't do with our coaches either. We are here to win games, and we are here to go to the playoffs. So
he said, you either execute or you don't. Was the line?
I think most of us felt that was putting Bill on notice a little bit. Like, you don't get to. I don't care what you did 25 years ago. We haven't won now consistently in 4 years since Tom Brady left. We're not a playoff team. We're not a consistently good team. So I let you dabble and have your little buddies run the offense last year, and you made some changes. So if things get better this year, great. But if your way of doing things doesn't start to end in wins, we'll move on. Like, at the end of the day, football is a business, and Robert Kraft cannot lead with his heart. He has to lead with his head.
By the way, I've heard rumors that Kraft has already been speaking to Meek Mill about taking over the team.
By the way, I have to say this. Someone called him Mr. Kraft yesterday.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, Jim would lose his mind.
Can't.
But you know what he said? He goes, please don't call me Mr. Kraft. He goes, I don't like that. He goes, that was my father. Please call me Robert or RKK.
Really?
I love that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Speaking of him, I want to say something good about him, too. Here is Kraft or RKK speaking with my former colleague at NECN, a friend of ours, Paul Evan, now CBS Boston, about why he sees a need, $25 million worth of a contribution need for his foundation to combat anti-Semitism. Here it is.
We're at a danger point, I'm sorry to say.
It is remarkable to hear you say that what you're seeing happening now, you've never seen in your entire lifetime.
Never seen it. The hatred and bigotry and anti-Semitism.
You find it scary?
Well, it's disturbing.
It's $25 million of his own money. I know it's not a lot to him, but still, to his credit. And by the way, Brady, I'm told, is joining in the effort. I don't know what that means. And Meek Mill and some others. So it's a good thing. You know, there's an interesting story I think you sent to us that we wanted to talk about. I think it'll resonate with a lot of people here. The headline was it Sports Illustrated? I'm not sure. The death of the Sports
Illustrated
anchor.
It was John Wertheim, by the way. He's also a 60 Minutes correspondent. He did a fantastic sit down with Charles Barkley. But this was an interesting article.
I love Charles Barkley.
So do I.
He's such a great commentator.
He's going to be on your
so
favorite
funny.
Cable station soon. Apparently, Gail King and Charles Barkley are
CNN,
moving
right?
to CNN. Well, not moving. She's going to be doing CBS and CNN. And Barkley's going to be doing, is it TNT he's on? Whatever
yes.
he's
yep,
on.
He's on TNT.
And CNN.
Like TNT TV.
Should be interesting. In any case, explain what the thesis of Wertheimer's piece is.
So it's been the death of local sports people.
Yeah.
And so he's using really Boston, Los Angeles, and New York City as sort of his examples, where here in Boston, you know, Bob LaBelle everybody knew who Bob LaBelle was.
Everybody
knows
great
who he was. He was a star. It was Rogan. I'm blanking on his first name in... Fred Rogan in Los Angeles. And you have three big guys that were in New York. And these were, like, you tuned into your local sports station to get your sports news. It was, and it started where it was like a department of six people and you had 5 minutes. And then sports got cut down to 4 minutes. And then sports got cut down to 3 minutes. And the same thing happened. And the reason I sent this to Jim and Marjorie is because last week Jim was lamenting sports betting and all of the ads. Dan Shaughnessy wrote a column about it in the Boston Globe. And I said, listen, for those of us who work in sports who have seen salaries decrease, departments get smaller, time on the networks gets smaller. It's in large part because eyeballs have shifted and moved, one, to regional sports networks like mine, but also places like ESPN, but also because they just don't have the ad money anymore. Like, places where we used to get advertising dollars used to come from car dealerships, sure, and car, yeah, models. And now that's shifting. Like, that's why I like sports betting, because that money is coming in and it's keeping people employed.
That's why she likes sports betting.
Well, that, and it's kind of fun. Like, if UConn wins, I didn't put anything down. I used bonus bets. I'm going to win like three.
You know, but let me just say, in fairness, so that people don't think that Wertheimer should have only picked on the demise of the superstar sports anchor, you could say the same thing about local news anchors.
Oh,
there's,
yeah,
no Chet Nat anymore.
Nope.
There's no Liz Walker. And then, by the way, no disrespect to some fabulous anchors on the news. They're great. But there's nobody who's like the go-to person who people say he or she is the authority. Just doesn't exist anymore.
No. And if you work in a newsroom like all of us have, whether it's a newspaper, a radio station, or a television station, everything is getting smaller and smaller and smaller, which, you know, listen, my bosses are going to hate me for saying this, but it affects the product. It affects how good you can, how well you can do your
job. By the way, you don't have to worry
job.
About pissing off your bosses. You win the UConn bet, you're set. I mean, you don't have to worry about anything.
I don't think winning like $380 is going to make me set, but it'll make me really excited. But it's true. Like, I had a friend text me today and say she's been working on this 3,000 words piece for The Athletic, and I was shocked that her editor went through and made very detailed edits, has her move things around, and she was like a little annoyed, right, because she's got to like rework this entire piece. But I was like, you have an editor who cares. You have an editor who reads your 3,000-word piece and wants it to be the best it possibly can. The number of times I read The Globe, The Herald,
with
our own website.
Mistakes.
Grammar mistakes, mm-hmm, spelling mistakes, sentences that clearly, like, you had started to write something and then went to delete it and change it, but it just doesn't get caught. Like, that attention to detail, we don't get to do. I had someone ask me why there wasn't an investigation into a story that had kind of been popping up on blogs, and I was like, resources. Like, investigative reporting is really hard. It takes time. It takes money. It takes resources.
Well, we're about to deal with one of our investigative reporters at noon, and that is so. Whether it's a spotlight team or GBH,
yes. Like, please, have a subscription. Like, don't cancel entirely your cable and your local news stuff. Like, those things are important to journalism.
After the Final Four, buy a subscription for all your friends. I mean, you can go on vacation.
I have subscriptions to almost
everything. We are on a time here.
My husband hates it.
Speaking with Trenny Casey, she's an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports
Boston.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Good to
coming
see
up,
you.
As Jim just said, our deputy investigative editor at GBH News Center, Jennifer McKim, she's an investigative reporter, and she's discussing her latest story on dozens of lawsuits, claiming malpractice against a Shattuck Hospital surgeon. She's next on GBH Boston Public Radio.
I'm Jim Browdy, head on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. A new report out of the GBH News Center for Investigative Reporting focuses on a controversial and some say dangerous prison surgeon and the systems that can enable medical abuse. Our colleague Jen McKim will join us. Then it's Cambridge Cicada Coffee Bar chef and co-owner Vincenzo Lay, whose creative and joyful take on Vietnamese cuisine is getting recognition from the James Beard Foundation.
I'm Marjorie Egan. The Florida principal who left her job after parents raised hell over sixth graders peeping Michelangelo's David has been personally invited by the mayor of Florence to visit the city that hosts the famed sculpture. We'll talk about that and the latest on arts in the Commonwealth with GBH's Jared Bowen. Then it's the Boston Globe's business columnist Shirley Leung on whether this new MBTA general manager can actually turn the trains around and finally get the system working again. All that ahead on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library and streaming at youtube.com/GBH News and facebook.com/GBH News. Hello again, Jim.
A couple of things. One, Elizabeth Warren is with us tomorrow. If you have questions, you could tweet them in to us and we'll consider them. But one extension of the discussion that started the show today about this massacre in Nashville yesterday,
I'm going to read you a quote from the congressman, Andy Ogles, who's a Republican that represents the district where the Covenant School is. He said his family was devastated by the mass shooting. His thoughts and prayers are with the families of those lost. As the father of three, I'm utterly heartbroken by this senseless act of violence. I'm closely monitoring the situation and working with local officials. We're going to put up now the Christmas card from Congressman Ogles. That's the congressman who is devastated by the shooting. That is the congressman, his wife on the other end, his two teenage children with holding AR-15s, and apparently they didn't have a fifth one for the little child. Four of the five family members greeting people at Christmas holding their AR-15s, and he is devastated by the fact that an AR-15 just caused the execution of six people in his district. You know, the hypocrisy and the selfishness and the nauseating conceit of these people is just, it is stunning to
Governor
me.
Governor Sununu is taking a little grief up in New Hampshire.
Well, explain what we just heard from Henry.
He's going to the NRA, supposed to give a speech at an NRA meeting, and I guess people are pushing back against the would-be presidential candidate.
In any case, right now, though, at the Shattuck Hospital in JP, one surgeon has been the target of more than 20 formal complaints from patients claiming medical malpractice, many, if not all, incarcerated people, many of whom lack legal representation. We're joined now on this story by Deputy Investigative Editor Jen McKim. Jennifer is with the GBH News Center for Investigative Reporting, which is spectacular. Jen, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Congratulations. Can you pull your mic up just a drop?
Yeah,
that's great.
So
thank
much.
You.
Yeah, congratulations on great work, Jennifer,
as always,
and this stories and many other stories that we talked to you about. So let's start with, tell us about this physician, this doctor.
Yeah, so basically the story started because I started hearing from advocates and sources who said you really need to look at this orthopedic surgeon at the Shattuck Hospital, which is the state's public hospital that takes care of the poorest patients in the state, including prisoners, mentally ill, and homeless people. They said you should check her out because there are so many complaints that she has done negligent, made mistakes, made people worse than when they started out, that her treatment of patients is with disdain, she doesn't listen to them. And so we started to look, and we found that there were 20 lawsuits filed against her, actually all by prisoners, over about the last 15 years.
And what's happened to that? Many of them don't have legal representation or the finances to hire, for example, an expert who can give expert testimony about the medical condition, right?
Exactly. Of course, you know that in civil suits, they are not offered legal representation. So a lot of these people filed on their own from their prison cells without any help. And basically, have no chance of winning in most cases, and none of them have at this point.
So let's talk about some of the allegations. Some are from a guy who is now released, Matthew Tottenham. Here's a clip of what orthopedic surgeon Adriana Carrillo, Carrillo is how you pronounce her last name?
Yep.
Told Mr. Tottenham before he had foot surgery performed by her.
Dr. Carrillo explained an easy, relatively painless surgery to me. Said I'd be walking out of the hospital that day and I'd be back to full recovery in a week.
So Matthew Tottenham said he was told full recovery in a week. Here's a clip of the same man, Matthew Tottenham, sharing his experience waking up after this foot surgery that was performed by Dr. Carrillo.
When I woke up, I was in so much pain. I told the bedside nurse, like, hey, you know, something's not right. I'm in a lot of pain, like a lot of pain. My foot felt like it was burning. Like it was on fire. Like I felt like my head was gonna pop off. I wasn't walking out of there. They knew I wasn't walking out of there. I got put in a wheelchair and wheeled out of there.
What happened? What happened to him? What actually happened from Carrillo there?
So he claims in his lawsuit that he went in for one kind of surgery and he was given two. The second one he had not consented to, which was a bunionectomy. And he left in a wheelchair. He was in so much pain. He was sent back to prison. It got terribly infected. A couple months later, he had to go back in for another kind of surgery. And he felt like he was given no consideration. He begged for help back in the hospital from the same doctor. He said he wouldn't even get
like damage bandages from her. And he got so upset about it that he ended up filing a lawsuit.
And what was the, can you, I'm sorry, your mic, can we get another headset for Jen, please?
Yeah, I think the microphone
here?
Is loose. It keeps falling off her.
What is the response from Carrillo or her lawyer as to the allegations from Mr. Tottenham? You'll answer in a second because you're, oh yeah, now it's okay. There.
So,
what's the answer?
Well, basically, the doctor never responded directly to me, but through her attorney who reached out to us the day before our investigation ran, basically said that all these lawsuits really are without merit, that these are prisoners who have a lot of time on their hands, that they're litigious, that she's doing, saints work by working with these very difficult patients that nobody else wants to take care of.
And Tottenham is not an outlier from what you're reporting, again, 20 lawsuits that you're aware of filed. Give us a sampling, Jen McKim, of what are the other kinds of things that some of these people who either incarcerated or were incarcerated are suggesting she got wrong.
So I spoke with a man named Joe DeLong, who's still in prison. He actually persuaded a judge to give him a lawyer and get expert testimony, and found out that, who confirmed that she had left a piece of metal in his knee, so that determined that she was negligent for leaving the metal and not telling him. But then he lost his lawsuit because the expert said it didn't cause him what he said was excruciating pain in his knee for a whole period of time. There's a lot of folks who talked about getting injections that ended up making them worse than when they showed up. Somebody got a hip surgery, I believe, and he claimed that his leg came 2 inches shorter at the end of it, and he limps, and he's in pain all the time now. And not only are the 10 formal lawsuits filed by prisoners, but we've also spoken to a lot of folks from prison who didn't file a lawsuit because they didn't know they could, didn't know how, didn't have the resources, but have also had similar complaints. So there's folks who have said this, and what we understand that this is bigger than just the 20 who we talked to.
Well, you mentioned, Jennifer McKim, that the Shattuck serves a lot of indigent people. But one of these stories also mentioned a board certification issue with this physician.
Right. So Adriana Carrillo is not board certified in Massachusetts to do the work she does. It's not required by law to do it. But we talked to different hospitals, all the main hospitals in the area, who said we wouldn't use someone like that. So basically, from what my understanding is, that she would not be able to be performing in other places.
So is my guess is that maybe they're getting her cheaper or something because she doesn't have the ability to work at one of the other hospitals in Boston?
One would wonder why, with so many complaints, the state has kept her. The state told me, the Department of Public Health, that they had no formal patient complaints about Dr. Carrillo at the Shattuck Hospital, and explained to me that doesn't count lawsuits, which they don't consider formal complaints.
So but you talked to...
wait a second. A lawsuit is not a formal complaint. Filing an administrative claim is a formal complaint, but litigation is not a formal complaint?
That's what they told me. I asked that multiple times because I have access to all the lawsuits.
I'm sorry, Marjorie.
But you have another physician who used to be at the Shattuck, Katharina Armstrong. What does she have to say?
Right. So as we were doing out this reporting, we started to realize that the issue isn't just about this one surgeon, that there's a lot of complaints from former and current physicians and medical personnel at the hospital that there's a real problem with accountability within the staff. Dr. Katrina Armstrong, who left there in 2019, she said she complained particularly about Dr. Carrillo as well as a bunch of other things. And she resigned because she felt like she could not perform the standard of care that she felt she needed to.
She
as a
referred
doctor.
In your reporting, she referred to Carrillo as a, quote, dangerous surgeon. So there's some board of registration or some such thing that we both know this, Andrew Meyer. Drew Meyer,
great,
who's a medical malpractice lawyer,
been around for a long time,
to this board as a protection racket for doctors in your reporting. What is their responsibility, and what have they said, if anything, in this case of
Well,
Carrillo?
They don't actually respond to reporters, but we from the Department of Public Health.
Why am I not surprised?
But go ahead.
But so the Board of Registration in Medicine does receive complaints. We found 8 complaints that were in her public file related to her treatment of mostly prisoners, although they redact a lot in those records. There has been one medical malpractice payout that she has given last year, which was for $45,000, her attorney tells me, because she started a procedure on the wrong ankle. and left a scar, but they stopped it before it was completely performed. But basically, the Board of Registration has done nothing in terms of any type of reprimand for Dr. Carrillo.
Well, you know, I think it's important to point out, these are indigent people, people who are prisoners, people who may be homeless. But if you are a hypochondriac over there, Jim Browdy, who has the record for more MRIs in a single year than
very
any
proud
person
of it too
in the state of Massachusetts, even someone like Jim would have a very difficult time with a medical malpractice suit. This is what Drew Meyer...
Not as difficult a time as these people
no,
have.
Right, but
that's
what
Drew Meyer said. It's almost impossible.
Yes, it is. And why is that?
Well, because to win a medical malpractice lawsuit here, you need to go through a medical malpractice tribunal at first within a panel of three judges to persuade them that you have some validity to your complaint. And to do that, you have to have experts, which cost lots of money. Matt Tottenham managed to get through the tribunal without an official expert, just by you know, playing willpower. He said he went in there and they said, there's no way you're going to win this. And then he did. And so, but he did lose his lawsuit in state court. Now he's filing, he's going to file an appeal.
The reason I mentioned that is because there is a real problem with the Board of Registration of Medicine, and it impacts the people that are in prison far worse.
You think
absolutely.
If 20 upper middle income people, white people like me, filed a complaint against or litigation against Cirillo, you think they'd be as?
I think it's difficult. We can all remember cases where people had pretty legitimate medical malpractice complaints and things did not happen as they should have. But anyway.
Well, it's so really hard with prisoners too, because not only do they have no money, but if they got in front of an actual court or a judge, they're fighting all the stigma of being prisoners.
Exactly.
They are not sympathetic people. So.
So what, let's assume for argument's sake, there's some merit to at least some of these 20 lawsuits and to some of the unfiled damage that these inmates say that Cirillo is responsible for. Is this the end of the story? I mean, obviously, you've shown a dramatic light on it, which may have a dramatic impact on what happens here. But what recourse, other than individual action, do people who feel aggrieved by her
Well, again, I think that a lot of the doctors that I've been hearing from who worked at the Shattuck and who have left the Shattuck are saying this story is much bigger than this one doctor, that there's so many problems in there that make it really hard for them to care for the poorest patients in our state, and that we should be looking at this more as a bigger investigation. These doctors, wrote a letter in 2019 and 2020 to the Department of Public Health and CC'd Governor Charlie Baker saying this is a toxic, hostile workplace and patients are at risk. We had them on Greater Boston recently, and they're calling still for an investigation to look at this hospital to make sure that patients are getting the best care and that doctors can do the work that they want to do.
What did the Baker... Was that Monica Burrell's time when
Correct.
She was public health
it
commissioner?
Was to her.
What was the response from the Baker administration?
So at the time, they sent someone in to talk to the doctors. They told me that they responded and resolved any issues. They did say that since 2020, they have worked to improve accountability at the hospital and to improve service there, but I didn't get a lot more details.
If a person like Matthew Tottenham believes he has gotten inadequate, if not dangerous, medical care at the Shattuck, do they have a right to petition that they get medical care elsewhere, even if they can't prove to the standard of, as Marty and you have talked about, medical malpractice, sustaining a lawsuit like that? Can they make a case that they are entitled to?
Well, that was what was so interesting about reading through these court cases. A lot of the prisoners would file temporary restraining orders, like, please don't send me to the Shattuck,
really?
Anywhere else but the Shattuck,
wow.
And actually would try to negotiate that as part. So generally, no. I mean, basically, they're prisoners. They have to go where the state wants to send them, or they have to refuse care. But in some cases, I spoke to a woman recently who's in a wheelchair at Framingham, and she said she's managed to persuade the state to send her somewhere else, and she thinks it's perhaps because she's complained so much about the treatment she got at the Shattuck.
So they, so she was hauled down from the Framingham State Prison for Women to the, for her treatment at the Shattuck, and that's the only option for even for the women up there in Framingham.
Oh, all of them. That's, I mean, if you can't get served within the prison, you get brought to the Shattuck in chains, you know, guarded with two guards to this place that so many people feel. I mean, basically, Tottenham, this other man I talked to.
The one that went in with back pain came out in a wheelchair?
Right.
Yeah. What did he have to say?
So actually, I didn't speak to him. His he actually has persuaded a judge, got so interested in this that he appointed a pro bono attorney. So that case now has a real law firm working on it. So they didn't speak to me on the record.
So what's the next chapter for you and this?
Well, I'd like to continue. I've talked to, since the story ran, I'm hearing from more doctors, more medical personnel who are saying you really do need to look at the entire system. And at the same time, I'm trying to see what happens with this one doctor. So we're definitely keeping an eye on it.
Great. I mean, it's fabulous reporting. And,
Thank you.
And to say that there, I mean, to say that people who are incarcerated are not just punished by the incarceration, but punished again and again and again through their health care, through it's just, it is horrible. And it's lucky they have somebody who's sounding the alarm like you. So thanks for doing it.
We wanted to mention too that you guys have done some great work on labor exploitation, labor trafficking, and we had this story about this pizza chain owner that was in big trouble now for years, beating up, assaulting, allegedly sexually assaulting, physically assaulting, underpaying all these workers. Tell us about that case.
And right. Imprisoning them, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. This was a really interesting case, particularly because we have been looking at this issue of forced labor now, an ongoing series over the last year, and basically we showed that there hadn't been one forced labor case filed by, you know, the current federal prosecutor, or there's been three in 22 years. So this case just landed, and it's related to a pizza chain owner who basically was charged with crazy types of alleged abuse of keeping someone working for more than nearly 14 years, beating him up, abusing him, paying him almost nothing.
Knocked out his teeth.
Teeth, so he had to wear dentures.
Upper and lower teeth. And he hit him so hard in the groin, he had to have an operation.
Exactly, all of
that. I mean,
that.
Unbelievable.
And he was charged formally with this one case, but the story is that there was all these other undocumented immigrants who were also, and basically it really fit the story that we've been reporting on, which is that undocumented immigrants who come here are so afraid sometimes that they end up staying in situations you can't even imagine they would.
Well, you did that great piece about the nanny in Brookline, right?
Right.
People that story if people don't remember from when you were here or having heard the report itself.
So we focused on these domestic workers who had come from the Persian Gulf with their employers who were using the hospital and basically trapped in their houses, not allowed to ever leave, working from 6 in the morning till 12 o'clock at night, maybe making a couple dollars an hour, unable to go out on their own, terrified with their documents taken from them. But we also have a restaurant case of a restaurant worker who said he worked for years in terrible, terrible conditions, but was, again, afraid because basically people would say, if you complain about your treatment, we are going to call the immigration services and you are illegal here. And so that case in Dorchester is just totally fits into what we've been hearing has been happening.
By the way, the case, Stasha's Pizza, is that Rachel Rollins? Is that the U.S. Attorney's
Office?
Yeah,
so that's a federal case.
So is the hope that with that they'll begin to take more seriously? I mean, Rachel Rollins is new to that office, let's keep in mind, but go ahead.
She's been talking about this since she walked into the office last year, that she created a human trafficking office, and they had filed many sex trafficking cases, which are much more common, and this was the first time that she filed one related to labor trafficking.
You know, one of the comments I made, which I don't have substantiation for, so I probably shouldn't have made it, so I'll make it again. I always quote, my favorite quote from Me Too was Quentin Tarantino, the famous director, who said, "We all knew enough to have done more." It is impossible for me to believe. I don't know if I asked you this when we were talking about that woman who was essentially imprisoned in the basement, the nanny that you reported on, or I can't pronounce his last name, the guy at Stasha's Pizza. It's impossible for me to believe if the family that imprisoned the woman in the basement had no friends, never had a person over, which obviously is not the case, that somebody didn't, there was not some suspicion raised. Friends of the guy who owned this pizza joint or who patronized the pizza joint, who saw this guy there at absolute all hours, 7 days 7 days a week, it's fair to say that there are people who know what's going on, or at least have an inkling that there's a problem, who choose silence.
Well, as you know, of course, he's innocent until proven guilty. And I went over to the Dorchester Pizzeria, and the manager came out and spoke to me, and he spoke totally in support of his boss. And he thinks this is all made up. So I don't know.
Well, we also don't know if he's telling the truth.
Yeah, so, of course. But it is true that when we did the restaurant story, we talked to some advocates who said they can't even walk into a restaurant with worrying about
that type
of abuse.
Yeah, that what's going on behind the scenes.
What do you mean? It's so widespread that they can't even
enjoy their meal.
Right, that they start looking at the people in the back, because it's really those guys, the ones who are chopping up the food, mm-hmm. doing the dishes, that are most likely for this type of
abuse. Well, also, the news story suggests that in addition to imprisoning these people, they're going to hire 14-year-olds to do all these kind of things too. Your reporting and that of your colleagues, we were talking to somebody before about how labor intensive and how expensive spotlight teams, GBH investigative team, it is really, I hope people know how much person power. And by the way, you have BU kids working with you. Did you not on
this? Well, we did. This project also was a project that was launched in both the Shattuck piece and the labor piece was launched in our Boston University investigative journalism class, which I don't teach anymore, but at the time, students got involved. They were very helpful.
Great.
And I am very grateful to GBH that gives us the time to do this work.
Is that the program that, the thing that McGorry is now running? Brian McGorry is head of the journalism department, right? Yeah, that's great. Great. Congratulations again. Thank you. And we'll have you back and we'll talk about
love
it more.
That.
Thank you
Jennifer McKim.
Congratulations. Another great piece of work. We've been speaking with GBH Deputy Investigative Editor Jen McKim with the Center for Investigative Reporting here at GBH. Okay, coming up, Vincenzo Lay, co-owner of Cicada Coffee Bar in Cambridge, the most beautiful coffee bar I've ever seen. He's up next to talk about being named a semi-finalist in the upcoming James Beard Awards. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library and streaming at facebook.com/GBHnews and youtube.com/GBHnews.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library. Changing pace here. We're streaming on Facebook and YouTube.com/GBHnews. Vincenzo Lay is co-owner of Cicada Coffee Bar in Cambridge. He joins us now at the BPL. Before I finish his introduction, I should say to you know that I always go to a restaurant before we have a restaurant owner. The problem here is you can't get into place because people are lined up and down Prospect Street, apparently for good reason. Vincenzo Lay is a James Beard semifinalist in the Emerging Chef category. The narrowed list of nominees will be announced tomorrow, by the way. It's great to meet you. Vincenzo, thanks so much for being here.
I
really appreciate it.
Thank you for
having me here.
And since we couldn't get in, we did see some wonderful videos of your place online. So elaborate on what Jim said. Tell us about Cicada.
Tell me about Cicada?
Yes, tell us about it.
Cicada, it means summer.
It does.
Summer, that means no structure, no school, no working, just wander around, hang fun with friends. Pick up the fruits and hang out in the neighborhoods. Cicada remind me about my childhood, remind me about the time I relax.
Is this when I read a story about the genesis of this, Vincenzo, you're either back in Vietnam or you're in Vermont, I can't remember, and you're just communing with nature, and then all of a sudden the spirit of the cicada sort of entered you in a fashion. I mean, what happened to you that you had this epiphany, this moment where you decided cicada was the thing for you?
So I came back to Vietnam after I came to the U.S. 10 years ago, and then I went to the grad school for urban design, urban planning at the Columbia in New York.
You're an architect, are you not?
Used to be the urban designer and architect. And then I came back to Vietnam and then I opened my Y Bar in Hanoi. And it used to be very popular. But my love is still here. So I came back here. And then I tried to go back again, but the pandemic came over, so I didn't have anything to do. And the plan was that I want to open the restaurant and coffee shop, restaurant from beginning.
Yes.
And then we signed a contract in Harvard Square, and then it didn't work because the pandemic came, and then we canceled it. So I was so disappointed, and I need to figure out what is next. So I went to Vermont for hiking with my friend and my lover. And then I heard the sound, and I said, what is that? Sikida. Actually, the sound from Sikida here in Vermont and the sound of Sikida in Vietnam is a little different.
It is?
It's a bit different.
How is it different?
The different, like, here, it's like shorter.
Yeah.
Really?
But in Vietnam, it's a longer. Uh-huh. Much longer.
Well, the cicadas in Vietnam, they speak Vietnamese, so they would sound a little bit different.
I think so. Or they drink too much of Vietnamese coffee shop.
That's right.
Too much Vietnamese coffee shop.
So that inspired you? Is that what it was? The walk through the wilderness in Vermont and the cicadas, and you decided, I know what I want to do and what I want to call this place?
It's kind of like I want to do something, but I don't know what and how.
Mm-hmm.
So I told my friend, and they didn't believe it. And on the next few days, I came back, and I say, I need to find a place.
And you found it on Prospect Street, but across from Whole Foods Market in Central Square of Cambridge, Massachusetts.
But it's just not, I mean, like I said, we've seen these beautiful pictures. You've got plants. It's verdant. It's got, describe what the coffee shop is. It's not just a coffee shop, obviously.
Yes. So I told the people that I designed Sikida Coffee Bar, a coffee shop, is for Cambridge people, specific. But from beginning, I came here and for the first 6 years, I still thinking about my hometown, still thinking about how to come back to Vietnam because I love it. And I didn't have a connection with the city. I didn't have connection with people And when I quit my job, I have more time to walk around the city and I know everything corners. And then I met a lot of different vendors and I like it more and like it more. And I get, you know, to know about the energy of cities. I hung out with Peter Valentine, the legend of the
Peter Valentine is a legendary Canterbridgian, I should say. If you live in Cambridge, you know Peter Valentine.
Yes. So we walk together, we hang out together. I know about more Cambridge. And then because my hometown also very funky and very hippie. So it's similar concept. And then when I design Sikida, I think I need to design something that's specific for Cambridge. And I collect over 6 months, I collect all furniture in the New England area, the vintage and also the mid-century furniture, and also to get to know about the concept, what does that mean, Cambridge? What does that mean, the space, and funky, and the lighting and is that, and then I put everything and combine everything together into one space. So when the people come to the shop, people say, I saw that chair, it's like my grandmother's chair. of course, because I collect it somewhere else. I love it. I love American mid-century chairs, like Gunlop chair. It's very stable, still elegant, still strong. Very elegant.
So well, that's your urban design architecture hat.
The eye.
By the way, I want to repeat, you were nominated in the Emerging Chef category. Tomorrow you find out if you make it to the next round. Are you nervous about tomorrow?
No, I'm not nervous about that. I'm not nervous about right now with you guys.
No, we got to talk about that. You are a live-in-the-moment kind of person.
That's right.
That's what you were saying a minute ago, right?
I try every day.
In the moment. Yeah. And the motto we've read on the wall is live slowly to feel deeply. What does that mean?
For example, right now, you just asked me the question, right? I need to think deeply before I respond to you. And I try because I have too much energy. I have too many things to do at the same time. So my own way, moving. So that's the statement to remind me to practice, to be slow and think deeply. Because sometimes we make decisions too quick and it's not, you know, it's a fact to the different people.
We do that every day. So what do you bring with you, Vincenzo? You have a lot of beautiful
and
things.
Great. I just want to ask you one question before. I mean, so you were an urban planner, then you switched restaurants, then you opened this coffee bar.
Yes.
It's not just coffee, restaurants, food,
that's
everything.
Right. But how do you get discovered by the James Beard people? Was there some spy that came into your place and reported that said this is a great rising young chef? How did that happen? Mm. Do you know?
I have no idea.
You have no idea.
They came and, I, to be honest, when I opened, for me, the coffee shop or the restaurant or any kind of shop, it's kind of public space.
Yeah.
It's related to urban design, urban planning, mm-hmm. because if you think this is the space that you can make the whole neighborhood, light up the whole neighborhood and make the people feel like, okay, I want to live here because that's a coffee shop or because a restaurant. So it's very related to urban planning, urban design.
Okay.
So for me, it's like when I do it for myself first because I love it. I like it. I'm not thinking I open it just because of James Beard at war or because any at war or anything about that. I do it because I need to survive over here.
You know what's interesting, by the way, before, and then we're finally going to hear what you brought with us. You know, you were an urban design person, an architect, mm-hmm. a person we've had on the show from Celeste and La Royale and mm-hmm. Esmeralda, Juan Ma Calderon and Marie Rondeau. Mm-hmm. He was a filmmaker.
He's my friend.
Before, he's a wonderful, mm-hmm. both of them are just wonderful people.
Yeah.
He was a filmmaker, now he nominated as one of the best restaurants mm-hmm. in America. I mean, it's interesting. You have a beautiful smile, too, by the way.
Thank you.
In any case, what'd you bring with you here?
Here, for drink, we have a shiso seka. It's a very popular drink in
what is it?
Shiso seka.
And what is
it? It's a coffee.
With condensed milk or no?
Slightly condensed milk and the main sea salt.
Can you explain to Marjorie didn't know. I've been to Asia a number of times.
I didn't know.
She didn't know about the whole condensed milk thing. Explain why.
So basically, like, you know, we, during the war with the France, after that, with American war in Vietnam, mm-hmm. we're very poor because we don't have fresh meal. But how we preserve the meal? So we make the condensed meal with sugar and milk and then keep it longer.
It lasts longer.
So preserve it. And then that's the concept come up with the coffee and condensed milk.
A little bit of sweetness. But how about the sea salt? Why do you add the sea salt?
Oh, that's a long story. But actually, the basic is that I went to the middle of Vietnam and there's a couple who live in the front of ocean. And they have a really tiny house like this. And the couple are very happy to make the coffee for everybody every day. And then I taste the coffee and say, what is that? And she told me that when they roasted the coffee beans, they put a little bit of salt and maybe a little fish salt inside.
Wow.
Interesting.
Okay, let's taste it.
All right, let's taste it.
We're okay, talking to Vincenzo Lay, who is nominated as one of the best emerging chefs in America. Semi-final round, James Beard. Tomorrow, the field will be narrowed, and we hope Mr. Lay here makes it to the next round. He's putting ice in a mixer.
Yes, it was like he's making a cocktail. And the James Beard Award, I mean, for people that win it, that's a big, huge deal. You get massive publicity all across the country, and people that haven't heard of you, oh, my goodness, look at you. You're like a, you know.
Well, he is not like that. He is.
He's doing it. He's doing it. He's shaking the cocktail.
She's never tasted anything like this before.
I told the people whenever they're working behind the bar, behind the kitchen, it's kind of the performance.
It is a performance.
This is my performance here.
I like it. I like the way you move. You know, speaking of performance, well, we'll get to that in a minute. Let's taste this drink here.
Okay, but taste the drink.
I'm going to live in the moment, Vincenzo.
Okay.
I'm talking to him. What do you mean? It's...
Okay, so thank you very much,
look how beautiful that is.
It is gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
That is gorgeous.
Okay.
Well, what do you think?
Delicious. That is really delicious.
Tell us what it's called one more time,
Vincenzo. It's almost like a coffee milkshake.
What is it mm-hmm. called again, Vincenzo?
Shiso Seka.
That's not going to happen here.
Mm-hmm. I don't have to worry about drinking the rest of my coffee now because I've got this coffee, which is much better.
So, Vincenzo, while you're making that drink, we're not going to get to the other drinks, but what are the other two containers? What are the other drinks you brought?
Oh, okay. So, and then I have a...
Whoa, where's my coffee?
Oh, sorry. Just so distract me.
You're going to love this.
What are the other ones?
Another one we have tea. It's called lemongrass ginger tea.
Thank you.
So we brewing the ginger and fresh ginger and fat lemongrass, and then we mix it a little bit local honey. It's kind of medicine.
And what's the third thing there?
This one, we have our own hot sauce with the spring roll.
Okay.
Ooh.
The hot sauce, I made it for New England, too, because I use a lot of apple, New England apple, to ferment it.
This coffee, which I cannot pronounce, is
fabulous. It's delicious. It's fantastic.
Really good.
Yes. I think we should sell this in store so I can go buy it. But, of course, I wouldn't be able to get the elbow action that Vincenzo has mixing the ice together. So tell people who may not have ever had it, that's probably not that many people, but tell me, what's Vietnamese food? What is unique about Vietnamese food?
The concept?
There's a lot of people who haven't had Vietnamese food.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't had Korean food. I suppose people have Chinese food, but it's Chinese-American food. But tell people about the... Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Vietnamese food. If you go into your restaurant, what are you going to get to try Vietnamese food if you never tried it?
Vietnamese food is very fresh with a lot of earth.
Oh my God! This is great. I love lemon ginger tea.
Okay,
so
back to the food.
Like
go ahead.
Sorry.
Let's go ahead.
I need it for myself too.
Okay, fine. On us.
It's wonderful.
You can smell a lot of ginger and lemongrass.
Yes, it's fabulous.
And no sugar.
No sugar.
No sugar.
Lemon ginger is very healthy for you.
Yes, and it's local honey.
Local honey. Mm-hmm.
It's a really amazing drink like this, and then refreshing during the summer. And you feel healthy.
It's great. Almost everything is locally sourced for you, is it not?
Ideally, I hope I can do that, but sometimes I cannot do that. So the honey is local.
So why don't you tell us what you brought?
Oh, it is
Jim wants to eat something. That's
all right. All right. It's a good time
hungry.
For people to take break, forget lunch.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Live in the moment.
That's my motto.
That's yes.
Right.
In the moment.
Okay.
You know, you're doing this, by the way, before you explain what that is, one of your skills, and you have many, Vincenzo, is we watched you cut a chicken blindfolded this morning on Instagram. Here's sound from that video. Again, it's Cicada Coffee Bar's Instagram. Vincenzo showing us how to cut a chicken blindfolded. We would not suggest you do this, while offering some insight on what makes the chickens in Vietnam taste better than chickens here in the U.S. Here's Vincenzo.
I really like chicken when I was little. I ate a lot of chicken because chicken is so tasty. But chicken in Vietnam is so amazing because it's a free range.
They can grab,
they're having sex, they have friends, they eat good food, and they have good life.
Did you ever see chickens have sex?
I did.
And how was that?
Many times.
But you did?
So the male, right?
Yeah.
Jump into the female.
Right on top there.
Yeah, right on top.
Yeah.
Just second.
Yeah, and they seem to enjoy it. Do you not get that sense?
Very enjoy it.
They do.
So do they taste
different? Wait a second. Let's stay on the
when you have a
second,
you have to be having joy.
But I want to know if they taste different because they have happier lives. Mm-hmm. Chickens in Vietnam taste different?
Yeah.
They do? How so?
Juicier.
Well, I can answer
there
that too.
Go.
They're smiling right before they're slaughtered, obviously, based upon
the muscle.
Their life
the muscle is very dense.
Exactly, yeah. I'm sure it is there, Vincenzo.
Yeah.
So, why do you bother cutting a chicken blindfold? I was a little nervous watching that. Why do you do that? What's the point of that?
I live in the moment.
I heard that. You live in the moment. That's
I came to the restaurant in the morning, and I go to the basement, and there my coworker is still doing things, and say, hey, my coworker boiled chicken for me because I love eat the whole chicken. Mm-hmm. And I saw the chicken. I said, let me do something fun. And then I just do it.
Oh!
Yeah,
it wouldn't be fun to cut off your thumb
would it? So how about give me a little hot sauce and one of those.
Are you sure you want to try this hot sauce?
Oh, yeah, I am totally sure.
Don't cry, okay?
I am totally sure.
Okay, don't cry.
If I cry, it's on me. Can I put it on here? No? You put it on my hand?
Yeah.
Okay. It's on my hand for those who are not watching. That is fab. Did you make that?
Yeah.
It's fabulous.
That's what he does, Jim.
What is this?
So we have a salmon spring roll.
Wow.
We have a mushroom spring roll, and we have a duck spring roll.
Salmon, please, sir.
Spicy or non-spicy?
Spicy. Come on,
okay,
Vincenzo.
Here we go.
Really?
This is a cashew sauce.
Get with the program here, yep.
And then the
which
salmon
is the salmon,
one,
right here?
Yes.
Thank you. You make these?
I didn't make it.
Who made them?
Michael Walker.
Who is Michael Walker? Does he work with you?
Uncle Fook and also Miss Ling.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll have the vegetable one, please.
But I trained them to make it.
You did.
They're beautiful.
So
they're beautiful.
You want salmon or something?
Vegetable. I'll have the vegetable.
Okay.
One.
This is a mushroom.
Thank you. Mushroom. Yeah. Perfect. Okay. Look at these. How
so
pretty
it's mango,
these are.
Oh
Noodle, rice noodle, and mushroom, and Thai basil, and cucumber.
Wonderful.
So, by the way, The spring roll is great. The sauce is spectacular. I mean, just spectacular. I know this is a hard question to ask somebody who owns a business. People don't like your place. They love your place. Yeah. I'm not exaggerating. I drive down Prospect Street every single night on the way home.
Mm-hmm.
I have never, never driven past Cicada where there's not a line out on the street. It can be pouring. Mm-hmm. It can be snowing. The other day, I think I told you this when I knew you were coming on. It is totally pouring. An Uber or Lyft driver stops blocking traffic mm-hmm. right in front of Cicada. Two people get out in the pouring rain and stand in line in the pouring rain waiting to get into your restaurant. That must make you feel good, no? In the moment, I mean.
How would you get into a restaurant?
You have to wait in line.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. That's a problem, too, because I don't want the people waste.
No, you don't.
I don't want the people like waste their time, but how can I do that?
No, you can't. What else do you serve besides these spring rolls and the coffee and the tea? And what other kind of food do you serve in this place?
We serve different food. But right now we serve black sushi rice with the baked salmon, kia salmon, and mushroom, and also duck. We have a noodle. We have a sandwiches, Vietnamese sandwich, banh mi.
A banh mi is best.
Yes, we have some appetizer, the eggplants, green papa salads. We have different things.
Are you about to expand into Bow Market? I read somewhere, I think, too. Are you about to have another place? Yes? No?
Yes, but I don't think I want to open now.
Right. Do you want to talk about it now or not?
Maybe later.
Maybe later, not
but
now.
But it's a very small space. It's only 15 seats, and it looks like a temple.
Okay.
It's like a place for me. Sikira, I can say, like, Sikira is kind of a young 30, 35 ladies.
Yeah.
But the new space it's about like 40, 45 guy love jazz and music and slow down, some whiskey on the side.
So what happens to a chef like yourself, restaurant owner like yourself, when you get into this James Beard competition? I mean, you become a big star, like, overnight. Right?
For me, it doesn't change.
Doesn't change?
I believe
that,
actually.
Who I am.
Yeah.
I like the concept. I like the rule of court. But at the same time, I need to remind myself, don't put the burden in my shoulder.
Yeah.
I still cook. I still hang out with my friend. I still do the thing. I still do the furniture. We furnish furniture. I still, you know, who I am.
So you also see, I think this comes through to people, your place is not just a cafe, a coffee place, a restaurant. You really see it as almost like a community center, like a gathering place for people in the center of Cambridge, no?
Yes, yes. So doing from the 8 a.m. until 3 p.m., we serve the coffee and some snack and sandwiches. From 5 to 11, we turn into the wine bar and food and drinks and a kind of four restaurants. But for me, Cicada is a community center because I see a lot of small vendors come over to hang out with me, and also a lot of artists. So we have space for people hanging their, you know, paintings, mm-hmm. and also I love the photographer come hang out with me, take a lot of photos. So for me, it's coffee. The concept of coffee shop in Vietnam or in here should be like the place that people get a connection, people hang out to know each other about the city, to know about what's going on. Some people they came, they just like so stressed out because like, you know, family issue because of the pandemic, but sometimes I just sit down with them and listen to them and share about being honest with them.
Are you as calm as this all the time?
It depends on the state of my life.
Okay, but most of the time?
During the summer, I can stay behind the backyard, in the backyard and hang out for an hour. Yes. But now, I don't think I can.
Do you get stressed at work or are you calm at work too?
I think the stress is the process of working. You need to get a constraint. You need to have conflict. You need to be stressed. You need to be like it, and then you open.
Mm-hmm. So, I love that.
Yeah, you cannot like okay. I work. It's a constraint and conflict make you more creative and more working hard, and you figure out it. That's the process of life. A process of doing small business. Small business is a lot of things going on every day. Okay, tomorrow could be leaking from the sink. Mm-hmm. And then the dishwasher are broken. The team member gets sick, so you need to cover them. A lot of going on every day, so you need to figure out day by day.
You know what you have to do, Vincenzo? You have to live in the moment. Do you know that? Right. Do you know that?
You living in the moment now doesn't mean tomorrow you're living in the moment. So you need to practice every day, every moment. You remind me, I remind you.
Yeah, I'll tell you.
Well,
so
this food has been spectacular.
It is
and the
spectacular.
Drinks have been spectacular. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, everybody, even though I can't get in the damn place, every single person I know, including one of my kids, raves about both the food, the atmosphere, about you as a person. What's the name of your partner? We should give her a little shout out too, right?
Oh, she's over there.
Oh, where is she? Yun, right here.
I think she took your picture.
Hi. How come you're not here, by the way? you just said one of us is enough for everybody.
Yeah.
Well, he's a pretty amazing one, and my guess is you may be too. We're really thrilled to have you here.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing the food and the fabulous drinks and the fabulous sauce.
This is a big thrill.
It's great, and we wish
thank
you
luck.
Condensed milk and coffee with salt, it is unbelievable. It's a perfect combination.
You leave these, whatever you leave, I'll drop by your restaurant, so don't worry. I'll drop them off on the way home.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, great. Jim will drop them off with an alternative. He wants you to
I want to get in.
Yeah.
So
the last thing I want to share that if you go to get a coffee bar and the lights long, just be patient.
Live in the moment.
Yeah, and we try the best we can, but let's just be patient.
Yun, does he really live in the moment, or is this BS?
He tries every other moment
to live in the
moment. Okay, congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much for coming in.
And Yun for their wonderful new small restaurant in Cambridge.
Vincenzo Lay, he is co-owner of Cicada Coffee Bar, which, as Jim said, is a James Beard semi-finalist in the Emerging Chef category, and that is a really big deal. The nominee is going to be announced tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Thank you.
We have
so
a lot of friends, by the way, as we said. The people from L'Oreal, which is Juan Ma Maria, Rachel Miller from Nightshade Noodle Bar, Tracy Chang from Pagu, a whole ton of people from our community are in the national semifinals. We hope they make it to the next
Boston
round tomorrow.
Boston is making its mark.
It is indeed.
As a food hub.
Indeed.
Anyway, coming up, GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen is here to give us the latest on Michelangelo's David. Is it porn or is it not porn? And why the mayor of Florence is getting involved in Florida's latest brouhaha. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH, broadcasting from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We are streaming, and we're live at the library, obviously, streaming at Facebook and YouTube at facebook.com/GBHnews and youtube.com/GBHnews. And by the way, we should have said this before, the fabulous coffee Marjorie and I are both drinking, I think, well, Jared's not yet, he may in a minute, is called Sea Salt Shaker. That's the ice version. It's great. The food is great. Cicada on Prospect Street in Cambridge. We're joined now by Jared Bowen. Jared Bowen is the host of Open Studio on GBH. He's the executive arts editor, too. I lost my notes, but I sort of remember who you are. You can catch the show Friday nights on GBH, too, and he's a friend of ours. That's all I know. Jared, it's good to see you. How are you?
It's great to be with both of you.
Thank you.
So, Jared, we talked last week with our listeners about something that just seemed totally crazy to me, that a principal, they're, of course, denying this is the reason, but it seems as a principal of this elementary school, a charter school that was centering on classical studies and liberal arts, got rid of the principal of that school because parents complain that Michelangelo's David, one of the most famous pieces of art in the world, is pornographic. Now the Italian mayor has gotten involved in Florence, which is where Michelangelo is. But what does it say about the state of affairs that parents would call this statue an artwork of this caliber?
Well,
pornography?
this is the new generation of the culture wars. We have myriad stories to talk about right now about how this is happening in all different forms, whether, and we'll probably talk about this, whether it's Dolly Parton or it's books or it's Michelangelo's David statue. So to remind people, and I know you just talked about this on Friday as well, yeah, there was a school in Florida that does have a Christian affiliation, at least when they started. I don't think they have it anymore. But they teach liberal arts, as you mentioned, and they have this course on classical art, and the David, Michelangelo's David, which is
up there on the screen,
been around for quite a long time. People are very familiar with this piece as part of this class discourse and curriculum. And so this teacher showed it without getting parental permission. So this is what the principal of the school is saying, is it's okay to include this. We've taught this before, but because you didn't get the permission of the parents, it's outlawed. Other people are now saying, you know, within their school district, other people are now saying this is the growing culture wars. This is censorship. We're seeing this more and more. But yeah, there's a lot of question about why an image of a centuries-old statue can't be taught in class. And one of the three parents who complained called it outright pornographic.
You know, can I just say something respectfully about this? It has nothing to do with the parents at all. It was a convenient, as soon as one parent complains, the DeSantises, the real DeSantis and the generic DeSantis wannabes, decide to use that parent as an example of parental rights are being violated, which, as you say, is part of the culture war phenomenon after the Glenn Youngkin campaign in Virginia. And this is not just, you said people are familiar, this is arguably the most recognizable statue in the world, I would say. And it's just, even, and by the way, she admits she forgot to send out the notice. She's not trying to cook the books here, this former principal. It is really nauseating. And if it was a one and done, you'd say bad. But as you say, with book banning, or at least attempts to ban books all over this country, including, we'll play the sound in a minute, David Letterer, head of the library here, said it's happening, in at least attempting to happen in Massachusetts. It's grotesque and really...
Well, and everything is being bastardized, because what does David
mean?
Represent? The director of the museum in Florence, where the David is housed, has said this is a... By the way, they're laughing at the United States at this point, and this is why they've invited the class. They've invited the principal who had to step down to come and see the David in person. But this is all about purity. This is a story of David and Goliath, a young man who's taking on a giant. This is about purity, that you can't change it beyond that. For any other representation, this is exactly what it is.
Well, you mentioned the Dolly Parton dust-up, so tell us what that is about.
So we move from Florida to Wisconsin now, where there's an elementary school, and these elementary school kids were going to sing a number of songs in a concert, and one of them is Rainbow Land, a song that in which Dolly Parton partnered up with Miley Cyrus. They have a great relationship. I believe she's her godmother or something.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and they go way back, including with Miley's father, Billy Cyrus.
That's too bad.
And... I did watch him in her holiday special.
We've got some sound. We've got some sound of the song. Yes, we do. So we're going to play a little clip from the high risk, according to these parents, song Rainbow Land.
To live, die, where we're free to be exactly who we are. Let's all dig down deep inside. Curse the judgment and fear inside.
That is a great threat to America's children.
Yeah.
It's pretty obvious.
What was the objection?
Living in a rainbow land where you and I go hand in hand.
Okay.
So apparently this is also a school where the teachers are not allowed to wear the rainbow flag because it may signal LGBTQ rights and support. And apparently you can't sing about rainbows anymore either. And that's the concern here, is that they can't teach anything, they can't say anything that might be at all politically controversial. And so this is why the kids were going to sing this song, brought it home to their parents, and there were complaints, and now they're not singing the song anymore. I mean, you've got to have a lot of courage to take on Dolly Parton at this point, who is basically the last person standing, who everybody in this country absolutely adores, practically.
And you interviewed her for your TV show, and you loved her.
And she's very careful, too, and I recognized that after interviewing her, that she is very careful to be as open and as accessible as possible to everybody. She doesn't want to sow sow division. She doesn't want to get political. She just wants people to love. And she believes in a higher power. She believes in God. She believes in blessings. And she just wants that to be part of who she is and what she can give back to the community at large. But that's not happening here. And so you think, well, is Over the Rainbow, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, going to be banned as well?
That's right. That'll be next.
It has this historic association with Judy Garland and, you know, LGBTQ people dream about a life over the rainbow.
That's
where
right.
The skies are bluer and
who
you
knows
can
what
have
the scarecrow was doing
the happier life that you want. But this is where we're headed, where everything can be parsed and then eviscerated.
Do you find in your research, you're an arts guy, you're the executive arts editor, I don't know if you know, at GBH,
I've heard
that when a conservative politician, this is one of my theses that I've been running with for decades, when a conservative politician expresses, how should I put this, heightened interest in genitalia, what do you generally conclude about that particular politician?
Well, going back to my early days, I
Please.
Think that there's a deep-seated interest in that that usually comes out about 6 to 18 months later with the investigation. We understand,
exactly.
Oh, yes, well, that tracks.
Exactly. But, I mean, that is not an idle comment. There is often a connection between personal perversion of a sort and an unhealthy obsession with David's penis in this particular statue. Would you not agree?
I have seen it more than once.
Thank
the,
you.
The story play. I've seen the statue,
I bet
too,
you
yeah,
have. But, exactly right.
But can we just mention, are we talking about the books next, too?
Sure,
about
go ahead.
Yes.
If people don't understand what's happening, as you mentioned, David Letterman, the head of this library, is talking about, there is a huge increase in the number of books that are being banned right now. It's increased about 700 to 800 just since 2021. And we're talking about books that deal with segregation, again, about gender issues and sexuality, that this is becoming the norm because 60% of the books that have been banned in this country are affiliated with school classrooms and school libraries. So this is closing in, and it's kind of funny to think about the David in one case, and it's kind of funny to think about Dolly Parton in another case. But when you start to look at this in totality, we need to have heads up here.
Well,
yeah,
you know,
Toni Morrison, I mean, The Bluest Eye, one of the classic books, The Handmaid's Tale, Margaret Atwood. I mean, that was been around since, what, the 70s, I think? And we had women dressing up in The Handmaid's Tale to protest all these crackdowns on abortion, too. It's about the basically enslavement of women, which some would argue is around the corner in certain degrees, anyway.
Right in the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
You know, one last thing about this book banning thing. What I think David Leonard said to us, but I know that virtually everybody else who's spoken about this in an impassioned way, says the difference between efforts at book banning now and what we grew up with 20, 30, 40 years ago is how organized it is. Is in most of those cases historically, there were individuals or small groups of individuals in a set community. But they say there's the same language. It's almost like they're submitting a form complaint, for lack of a better expression. So it's really an organized movement around the country, no?
Well, it's so much easier because we have social media now, so it can
of course,
be constructed
that's right,
and
yeah.
It can be waged that way. And the next thing they do, by the way, is the funding. They go after the funding. We saw that happen with Mapplethorpe in the 1980s, and they wanted to pull government funding from museum exhibition. I mean, the joke's on them now. There's not a lot of government funding in the arts in this country, so a lot of it comes from private philanthropy. But when do they start to target the private philanthropists? And when does it become too hot for them to suddenly give to museums or theaters or academic institutions that support the arts?
Can I change the subject for 1 second? I don't generally like sweet drinks. I love this Vietnamese coffee.
It's really good. Condensed milk and salt and coffee.
Sea salt and condensed
milk.
And
I'm getting a buzz from the coffee, so
Ooh,
it's
fabulous.
Caffeinated. Highly caffeinated, which I love.
Can we change gears to not be and talk a little Stephen Sondheim for a minute? Into the Woods, was that his first or no?
No, it came much later.
It did, okay. Well, I thought it was the 70s. When was Into the
1987.
Woods? 1987. Oh, I was wrong. Okay, fine. Tell us about Into the Woods.
So Into the Woods was a piece, I think a lot of people know it from their high school auditoriums. It's frequently done because everybody can access it because it's about fairy tales. Mm. And so Stephen Sondheim had wanted to create a musical really inspired by The Wizard of Oz, actually. He looked at that piece as you have all of these separate songs that advance the story, but each song is about a character, but each song also stands alone, speaking of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, outside of the film. And so he came up with Into the Woods. And what would happen if you meshed all of these fairy tales that have been spoken about and written about cross cultures? And so they did that with Rapunzel and Jack from Jack and the Beanstalk and Cinderella and Little Red Riding Hood. But he, with James Lapine, created an American fairy tale with it. And here you have the baker and his wife, and they just want to, it's in a very American story. They just want to have a family and they want an income and to live and have a happy life. So basically, they divide this between happily and then ever after. So we're talking about it because it's playing right now at the Emerson Colonial Theater just through April 2nd. This is a real treat, by the way. First of all, the show is phenomenal. But what they did is it was such a success on Broadway that they put the show, including, this hardly ever happens, the Broadway cast on tour. So you're seeing the Broadway cast come here to Boston.
I didn't know that.
Because I think they had so much fun doing it, and it had a somewhat limited run in New York, so it was easy to kind of put everything together and then send it on the road. But the really fun part of this is because you have the first act ends, and it's the happily ever after that we kind of all know. Cinderella gets her prince, Rapunzel's freed, and Little Red Riding Hood is trotting off, but then the ever after is what Sondheim and Lapine imagine. What really happens when your mother has kept you in a castle for a long time?
That's right.
Doesn't Rapunzel has some PTSD? So does Little Red Riding Hood from watching her grandmother devoured and then her being devoured. And Cinderella, well, if you're going to marry a prince, we know that doesn't often end well.
That's,
so
absolutely.
So this all plays out, but it's really ultimately stories about families and children. The two big songs that are standalones from this piece are No One Is Alone and Children Will Listen. This gorgeous, gorgeous meditation from Sondheim, who didn't have his own kids, about family.
When you think about Hansel and Gretel, isn't that one of the cruelest ones of all? That the mother, that the father and stepmother just want them to get eaten in the woods, and they leave them on the breadcrumbs to go off and go into the woods, and they could take them. I mean, what kind of, think about that, how much damage you probably did reading that story to our children. Did you
Hansel
read that
was elected to the Senate from Florida just last year, too. It's amazing because of that.
And the witch puts one of them in the cage, and she's going to eat them and put them in the fire. Oh, my God.
Well, a lot of fairy tales are grim. And
well, there was this guy
that
used to be on television when I was a kid, Bruno Bettelheim. I'm dating myself because this is back would have been like in the 70s, maybe earlier, when he talked about how since children have horrible fantasies about their parents anyway, this is kind of playing into their fantasies, of their fearful fantasies, and then showing them that it will all work out in the end. So what they're
supposed
to be sort of helpful.
Same deal, right? I mean, so many of how does Bambi start?
Oh, Bambi's mother gets brutally gunned down.
That's a hell of a thing for a kid.
Does she get gunned down?
She does. Somebody shoots her.
I'm not sure I ever saw that film for that reason.
Oh, it's horrific.
Could never watch that. Couldn't deal with that.
I remember seeing a movie, Old Yeller. They were going to kill the dog in the theater.
Oh, I loved Old Yeller.
My babysitter was so upset. I stood up in the middle of the theater and screamed, "Don't shoot her!"
Wait, you did?
I did. My babysitter was horrified. I did, yeah.
That's a beautiful story.
They shot him. And I was, you know, dealing with it for years.
I won't deal. I've never watched Old Yeller. I don't think I've ever seen Bambi. You know that movie, My Octopus Teacher, that was on Netflix?
No.
It was nominated for an Academy Award. No. And it's this beautiful documentary about this octopus and this relationship this man establishes with the octopus. And she's very tender and she's emotional. You can never eat octopus after seeing this again because you realize they have feelings. They touch you. They pet you. They want to have you, this connection. But I thought, this is not going well. So I turned it off 5 minutes before the film ended. So in my world, she's still swimming around happily ever after.
Because the octopus did not end well. Soul of an Octopus.
One of the great, by Cy Montgomery. One of the great stories, a nonfiction about a relationship with an octopus at the aquarium.
Yes.
Right down these streets.
Would come into the aquarium to visit the octopus would stretch a big tentacle out and put suction cups
like
up and down.
Was it nice?
I think Cy described it in an erotic way, and you know, each to his own.
Exactly.
Yes, she and the octopus.
Whatever you're into. But
don't put her anywhere near David. I'm just saying now.
That is
Florida will explode.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So if we only have time for one of these museum things, which is closing sooner? Which should we do here? Gardner or the Harvard Museums?
Well, I think we can talk about, let's talk about the Harvard Art Museums because they also, I'll talk about these in advance. Of they have a free museum night coming up this Thursday where you can have chocolate, you can find a DJ in the atrium and wander the galleries. And there are two really interesting shows on view right now. One is Bosco Sodi Origen. He's a Mexican artist who he sculpts these large spheres. At least he works in many different forms, but this is what we see here. So he came to the Harvard Art Museums, he visited them, and then went back and created these large spheres in clay that have to, after he fires them and they dry, it takes about a year-long process to create these, and they have this gorgeous texture, but they've put them on this terrace that's out just outside one of the galleries that has the Buddha and a lot of very mystical and sacred elements. So he's created these raw forms that sit outside on this terrace, and then others covered in gold, which he equates with being holy and in deference to these figures. And you get up close to them, and you just want to touch them, and you're allowed to touch them. And they each have their different painterly texture They are these earthen forms, and some of them have cracks in them. The way I walked through the galleries with him, and the way he was describing them to me, I had to ask him how he creates, and sure enough, he creates barefoot, because he himself wants to be connected to the earth, which I thought was really significant. And then the other show that I want to mention is, it's called From the Andes to the Caribbean, American Art from the Spanish Empire, and this is one of the first shows, certainly the first that Harvard Art Museums has done, where they really look at before the British, before the French established colonies here, Spain had colonies here. So what happened when there was that fusion of art, when you had the Spanish colonies or the vice royalties, as they were called in present-day Bolivia, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Ecuador, Venezuela, what happened when that art and those forms and that ancestry and history came here with indigenous artists, and what was the hybridity that happened for it to create?
Hybridity?
Hybridity.
Is that a word?
It is. I think it's
so,
a word.
Let's hope so.
What is the deal with the chocolates and the DJ at the Harvard Museum?
So they have established free. this monthly series where you can go free, and it's just basically a fun party environment. You get to really celebrate and all
that
come together and then look at terrific art.
You know, before you go, we've talked a lot about provenance, which I did not even know the definition of until we talked to you a few years ago. What's the name of the woman I had on TV with me from?
Victoria Reed. From the MFA,
right.
Yep.
She was great, who's the head of provenance or something. We've talked art, repatriation, that sort of thing. I was reading a story in the New York Times. Marjorie read it too. The Manhattan District Attorney's Office has a staff of 18 people who do nothing but repatriation work. That is unbelievable.
It is, considering where they started in 2010, having just one person in that office. Yeah.
So what's going on that front? Give us a quick summary of what the kind of thing they're dealing with.
Well, because I think you can be thankful for social media a little bit, because everything is so more readily available now, including pictures. I mean, one of the pieces I think that their office has repatriated is a sarcophagus that they saw Kim Kardashian posing next to at a Met Gala, and somebody else saw that and said, wait a minute, I know about that. That didn't come in legally, and they, sure enough, they went back through the records and recognized that this is in the museum and it wasn't rightly purchased, and so it went back. And so there's more of that, this vetting that's happening now, and there was a long period in this country where people just had free rein to go out and steal things and take things. The person who's leading this effort, his name is Matthew Bogdanos. He has a great book, it's called Thieves of Baghdad, that I read years ago, and he, in serving in Iraq, had recognized everything that was just flowing out of the museums there when the conflict started, and they're trying to get a lot of those pieces back. So this has been in him for a very long time, and now he's got this very robust staff to go after these the people who are still doing this, trying to get away with it.
Let me just say, Jared, speaking for myself, the only thing more beautiful than some of the art that you've been describing today is the fact that CNN is reporting that Pence was just ordered to testify about his conversations with Trump to a federal grand jury. Does it get any better than that? I would say the answer is no. Hallelujah.
Yeah.
What are you doing on, what day is this? Tuesday? What are you doing Friday?
Tuesday.
We are speaking with John Sayles, the film director turned novelist.
Oh,
he's
really?
He's just written a new book called Jamie McGillivray, tracing, it's a renegade story from sweeping from Scotland to the Americas.
That sounds fabulous. Is that it?
And I should mention, tonight I'm hosting the show formerly known as...
That's Greater Boston?
Jim Browdy.
Who do you have on?
We're speaking with Christine Keneally. She's just written this book called Ghosts of the Orphanage, which...
Oh, I read about that, actually.
This is really intense, amazing work. A 10-year investigation that has really traced the level of abuse that happened in this country and other places around the world. Another systemic abuse perpetrated often by the Catholic Church in orphanages, including here at Burlington, Vermont.
Oh.
People, these kids just horrible, horrible things. So she's uncovered a lot of what happened there.
Can I ask you one last question before you go? I'm sure you're asked this question repeatedly, so I'll ask you here. As good as you may be hosting Greater Boston, can you ever live up to whatever the guy's name was who hosted it for, I don't know, 8 or 9 years?
Never. No,
couldn't happen.
Every night I say,
I loved him, by the way.
Good night. The lights close, and they say, nope, you're still not there, Jared. Every time.
Boy, does that warm my
heart.
That's
right.
Oh, that's such great news.
The legendary host of Greater Boston.
Thank you very much.
Tragically,
are you talking about him or are you talking about me?
I was talking about you, Jim.
Thank you very much.
Okay, legendary. That's what we all say, in his own mind, at least.
Nevertheless, okay. Watch Jared tonight at 7 o'clock. Hosting Greater Boston. He's an imposter, but he is hosting Greater Boston tonight. Jared, it's great to see you.
Good to see you.
Speaking with GBH Executive Art Editor, host of Open Studio with Jared Bowen, and tonight the host of Greater Boston, where Jim used to have a seat, but no more.
No more.
Open Studio, catch it Friday nights, GBH 2 at 8:30.
I passed my badge to get me in the studio. It doesn't work anymore. It's unbelievable. When you're gone, you're gone, you know?
That is true.
Okay, fine.
Okay, thank you very much, Jared Bowen. Up next, Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young. She's going to tell us about the new head of the MBTA, the banking crisis here in Boston, and some child labor stories that are pretty shocking to be going on here in Massachusetts. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at your Facebook and YouTube, facebook.com/GBH News, youtube.com/GBH News. Elizabeth Warren joins us tomorrow, but joining us right now on Zoom is Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Young. Hello, Shirley.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hello, Shirley Young.
So our new governor, Maura Healey, has just appointed a new general manager of the MBTA. His name is Philip Eng. I'm going to play a little sound. When he was speaking to a bunch of reporters yesterday, here he is.
It's the best transit system in the world, and that's why I'm here.
Are you being serious?
We are going to work every day to provide the service that the public expects. I had the chance to talk to a lot of riders today, and while they are frustrated, they love riding the T. The status quo is not acceptable. And moving forward, we will be innovative, open to new ideas, and think of outside-of-the-box solutions.
Do we have any idea who the reporter is who said, are you being
sarcastic?
That was great. What a great follow-up.
Because needless to say, most of us do not think of the MBTA as the best transit system in the world. And if it is, the rest of the world is really in serious trouble. But what's the word on this guy, Philip Eng? I mean, he comes from New York. He had a big job on the Long Island Railroad there. And he worked at the Department of Transportation in New York State and stuff. So what's the scoop?
Well, as you know, the previous governor went through a lot of TGMs.
Yeah, and three, right?
I've lost track. I think there might have been more, but I think there's more than that. But anyways, what I like about Philip Eng, he used to run the Long Island Railroad, which is a big part of public transit in New York City. He's spent decades working in public transportation. He's an engineer by training. So this is a guy, and I've written about this. This is a guy who knows operations, knows transit, and that's exactly the person you need to hire right now. I had heard of him, and I thought he was, he had retired from the Long Island, the LIRR, and so I was thinking, oh, maybe he wouldn't come back. But I think we're lucky to have him to give it a go. And I love that clip that you played, because I remember reading about that too. The follow-up question is like, are you that sarcasm? Great follow-up question. And I don't know if you guys saw my colleague Joan Vanocki's column. She called it the Ted Lasso of public transit, right? So upbeat, like, I believe that we can turn the system around. But he's right. He's known for spending a lot of time in New York talking to commuters, talking to riders. And yes, riders are incredibly frustrated, but they show up every day because somewhere deep down, we want to love the team.
We do. We want it to work. We want it to go fast. I was in New York City over the weekend, and say what you will about the subway in New York, it goes very fast, and I'd love to see that in Boston.
You know, Shirley, one question about this, since you know all the players. We talk, you know, we have Jim Aloisi, former Secretary of Transportation, and Stacey Thompson, who's head of Livable Streets, on once a month with us. And the one note that they sound nonstop is the legislature's got to come up with a lot of money, a lot of money. And they've talked about different ways to get there. Does a guy who not only is an outsider from the T, but doesn't even have any experience in Massachusetts, stand a better chance with this full of itself legislature when it comes to funding? Or is it better it be somebody that it had been somebody who had connections? Because I think if I don't want to speak for Aloisi or Thompson, I think they would both say Eng could be the most competent person in the world. If the legislature doesn't ante up, it's bound to failure. What do you think about that?
Well, I think with a new administration, right, it's a chance for Governor Healey to make another case for the T and to advocate for even more money. And then there is the millionaire's tax,
true,
which will provide more funding. But as we know, right now, the ridership is not on the T, on the subway, is not returned to pre-pandemic levels. And part of that is the new, hybrid workplace. You know, people aren't riding 5 days a week. And because of the slow zones, which seem to be, you know, all over the system, someone like me, I'm in the red line slow zones. I really think twice about going downtown or taking the T because it's so slow. And so I think there's a whole group of us who are avoiding the T if we can. And so Aang has to get to the system in place to convince us to get back in the train more often. If not, there's going to be even a bigger fiscal hole, right? Because the T needs our revenue, needs our fare money.
Sure it does. By the way, he's starting really quickly too, April 10th. I mean, that's good.
Right, he's a consultant, right? He doesn't run another
system. Right, exactly.
Right, and so he retired. He's been a consultant, so he can start right away. I believe he has a daughter at Northeastern. So,
oh, I didn't know that. Oh, great.
He must be. Hopefully, he's already ridden the T already before he came here yesterday.
So, Shirley Young, let's move on to you did a great piece of reporting on this First Republic Bank, which apparently has also done some precarious lending, but you talked to a lot of people that have been involved with them. Steve DiFilippo from Davio's Restaurants. We've had the Urban Great people, TJ and Hadley Douglas on. They've worked with that bank, Institute of Contemporary Art. Tell us about First Republic and its ties to Boston and what this means for the people that are involved with this bank and the banking system in general.
So First Republic is one of these banks. It came into the Boston market in 2006, and it really focused on providing loans to jumbo loans, jumbo mortgages to wealthy customers who need very expensive homes, and these are kind of larger than normal mortgages to purchase these homes. They also, went after successful entrepreneurs. They went after real estate developers. They are one of the largest banks in Massachusetts now, much bigger than Silicon Valley Bank. And when investors started pulling money out of Silicon Valley Bank, other investors were looking, well, what other bank fits the same profile as Silicon Valley Bank? And that's why everyone turned their attention to First Republic. Like Silicon Valley Bank, which focused on, startups and venture capital, these two banks had a really large percentage of what they call uninsured deposits. So a lot of the FDIs, the federal government insures, accounts to $250,000. But because they have very wealthy customers, big corporate accounts, a lot of their accounts were over $250,000. So a place like First Republic, I think 68% of their deposits at the end of last year were uninsured. So that means if customers decided to withdraw their money right away, they might be in trouble. And that's what's happening right now. You know, they are almost living on borrowed time. You know, they've borrowed some money from the federal government. Other banks, rival banks, have deposited $30 billion to try to stabilize the bank. And what was interesting for me is that usually when your bank is in trouble, your customers are really pissed at you, right? They're so mad at you. Instead, what I found, the complete opposite. These customers got great service from the bank. They credited them with, you know, giving them money at the time they needed to grow their business. And someone like Steve DeFilippo, he said to me, I am sticking with this bank. I actually bought stock in the bank. I want this. We need to be there to support this bank because they were there when I was when I needed them.
You know, speaking of Steve DeFilippo from Davia's, I think I got this right in your piece. Tell me if I read late last night. So I don't know anything about banking at all, and I know you do. I think DeFilippo told you that while he's got a ton of money in First Republic, he divides it up into accounts that are all less than 250 grand. I assume people know that's the cap for the FDIC insurance. Obviously, in terms of Silicon Valley, the Biden said we're going to guarantee all of the deposits in the bank. Why doesn't every wealthy person do exactly what DeFilippo did, even if it means they have to have 1,000 accounts of $249,000?
You know, some readers wrote in, it's like, are you sure he's doing this right? I think, you know, you can open multiple accounts, but you have to have different ownership. It could be like,
oh, it can't be the same.
You know, it could be per restaurant, like the way he figured it out. So not every, I mean, you know, maybe it's his account, his wife, his kids, his each restaurant, you know, but I don't think that applies to everybody. But he has somehow figured it out. But you know, I talked to a developer, John Davis. He remains a customer of First Republic. John began started first working with First Republic in 2009 in the, you know, in the throes of the Great Recession when nobody would lend his money, lend him money to in the real estate business. And so and they did, and they worked with him, and they've helped him grow his company. John Davis helped develop the Omni Seaport Hotel. Yeah. And so, you know, he's like, listen, I have multiple, you know, I have relationships with multiple banks, but I do plan to stick with First Republic. He has like a, you know, money, you know, they help manage the, his money, his some, you know, I think he's got like a checking account, money market. I mean, think about a lot of these companies have corporate accounts where they do payroll. So there's a lot of money there, you know?
So can we switch around? We spend almost all our time discussing unimaginably horrible things happening around us in our country. The headline of a great op-ed by someone from the Center on Labor and Economics at Harvard Law School today, Terry Gerstein, who I don't know, said, are we actually arguing about whether 14-year-olds should work in meatpacking plants? There was a great story in the Globe following another great story in the Times shortly before. It's, by the way, it's not in some other place. It's also happening here. Underage kids, mostly migrant kids, working in roofing, meatpacking plants, fish plants, some of the most dangerous occupations. What's going on?
And it also said in this Globe story that one of the reasons we have fewer kids is because we have fewer large factories and meatpacking plants. Yeah. And maybe if we had more of them, they'd be working there as well. But anyway, go ahead,
what's
Shirley.
What's going on, Shirley Leon?
Right. So this, I mean, actually, they've been quite a, on the national level, they've been quite a good stories. And the New York Times did a story because, you know, there was a line in their piece was where they found underage children working in dangerous conditions in every single state, you know, in the U.S. And I think it made, you know, Katie Johnston wonder, well, where in Massachusetts? And indeed, you know, her kind of most, you know, heartbreaking example was teens working in the fish factory, right?
Yeah.
Slipping machines and sharp knives, incredibly dangerous dangerous conditions. They were, not documented and really basically the staffing agencies, like in other parts of the country, they just looked out the other way. I mean, the New York Times story, do you remember the kids working in Cheeto factories, right? And they would get sick taking in the fumes of the powders. And so these kids would work all night and then they would go
to school and they're falling asleep in class.
Directly, right.
Yeah. And then Kenny Johnson talks about baking dinner rolls that are sold at Walmart and Target.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's crazy is that these aren't working at – they're working for some of the biggest and most profitable companies in America.
Yeah.
And the companies, the bigger companies will say, we had no idea. We have use a third party staffing agency. And then you talk to the staffing agencies like, oh, no, we're above a board here. So above board here. So nobody takes responsibility. And you're right, Jim, it's outrageous. What we're starting to see is some states are actually making it easier.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the great Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the new governor of Arkansas, is making it easier to hire under 16-year-olds instead of making it harder.
She was bragging about it, remember, in her State of the Union
follow-up
speech? Yeah.
It's incredible. I mean, what we need to fix our immigration system. I didn't realize this until I read Katie's story. We do allow kids as young as 14 to work, but not in meat factories.
Exactly.
On a very low risk drugs. I'm thinking like probably scooping ice cream or something like that, but not to work in a fish factory or be a camp counselor or something like that, but not in these dangerous conditions.
The core of the problem where it all starts is, I think it was, must have been the New York Times story, mentions that to date, the federal government has lost contact information for 250,000 unaccompanied minors who came into this country. A quarter of a million kids.
Remember the kid that was trapped and kept trying to call the so-called hotline to get help? And
I mean, physically trapped in a machine? Is he talking about that?
No, trapped in a home, and he was trying to get in touch with the hotline, and the hotline number didn't work. He couldn't get through or something like that. It was really, really horrible.
You know, Shirley, we're short on time,
I got to get this. You have to get this out of your system, Jim.
I know I do. This story.
Jim does always say Tesla, la, la,
no, no, no.
La.
I'm not talking about the EVs. We'll talk about the EV charging another day.
Okay.
Is that okay with you?
Jim was very upset about it.
This story about the landlords complaining about the rent control bill, it is if, I've had this discussion with Marjorie about 1,000 times, there is not something called rent control. It is dependent upon the statute. Michelle Wu drafted a statute that was as landlord-friendly as any statute could be. It said that you can raise rents up to 10%, and the Globe story mentions virtually no landlords who are complaining about the proposal ever raise rents by 10%, so that's obviously not the problem. They're really concerned that it's going to limit development. This one guy, Persolet, who I've had some dealings with, says he may not be able to do business here anymore because you can't do new development. Well, it turns out she exempted new development for 15 years, I'm sorry. And the takeaway from this, the business community, I do not, is they can't even focus on the content of what she proposed because they're so up and on. Every one of them, their complaint in the Globe story is it isn't what she filed, it's what's going to happen after they get their foot in the door. What's your reaction to this reaction?
Well, we've talked about the first. I actually feel that Mayor Wu's proposal is quite modest.
It is.
I think it doesn't go far enough. I mean, I'm not sure how big of a difference it will make. But the landlords and the real estate industry are up in arms about this very modest proposal. I mean, I think the story said that the average rent increase over a 10-year period was like 4% or something like that. It was well below the cap that she's proposing. And the other thing, it was a very good story by my colleague, Andrew Brinker. The other thing is, know, if you're a landlord and you have a good tenant, you would never raise.
Exactly.
You either don't raise the rent at all, right, or raise it very little because you want to keep your good tenant. But I do think what Mayor Wu and advocates are trying to guard against is the really bad landlords, right? The ones, yes, the people quoted in Andrew's story, you know, did not raise the rent that much, but there are landlords who do, you know, and so she's trying to protect tenants from the bad landlords.
You know, before you go, since Marjorie thought I was going to squeeze the EV thing in, I would like you to talk to Aaron Pressman, your colleague, and make sure this is not a typo in his EV story. Let me read you this line. With or without Tesla, yes, Marjorie, I have a Tesla.
Tesla, la,
charger
la, la.
Availability will be improving dramatically in the next few years, Aaron Pressman writes. Massachusetts is getting federal grants, including $60 million from the Infrastructure Act to build, you ready for this? Dozens more fast chargers. We're going to take $60 million
Not gonna get far.
And build a couple of dozen chargers? That's got to be wrong, right?
I will ask Aaron so we can discuss this.
Oh, my God.
It seems like every time Aaron writes about EVs, it's bad news. Like, what is it? Like, I was surprised at the double-digit prices, right, for the cost of electricity. I was like, whoa.
Well, it's being passed along, obviously. And if you have a car that charges slowly, like most cheaper EVs do, and you happen to be at a charger that charges by the minute rather than by the level of electricity, you're really screwed is the bottom line. So talk to Aaron, get back to us. We'll talk to you next week.
I will.
Shirley, we love you. Great to see you.
Hey, Shirley, thank you very much. Great to see you as always. Thank you.
Thanks.
We've been speaking with Boston Globe business columnist Shirley Leung, and we very much appreciate her time. Up next.
Do you think for $60 million we should be able to build more than dozens of chargers?
I was surprised that was all $60 million got you. It was a few dozen. I figured it might be like hundreds, maybe even a thousand. But I guess I was wrong. Anyway, up next. This is a very important issue, Jim. We're getting right to the bottom of it. The rise and the staying power,
you're welcome.
Of the Croc. Those are those pretty ugly shoes that apparently are sweeping. They swept through America during the pandemic, and they're still sweeping,
and their
stock is going up. Americans love their Crocs. Are you a fan, or are you sick of seeing them anywhere and everywhere? Call us or text us at 877-301-8970. This is your opportunity. I know you've been waiting to weigh in on Crocs. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, broadcasting from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, live at the Boston Public Library, as we are every Tuesday and Friday. Streaming online at Facebook.com/GBH News and YouTube.com/GBH News. Senator Warren, who announced just yesterday she's running for a third term, will be with us tomorrow. Some footwear goes unnoticed, an understated afterthought to one's wardrobe. Not Crocs. They're bold, they're flashy, they're aesthetically questionable, and undeniably, I've never had them, comfortable. Sales boomed during the pandemic, as Marjorie just said. But unlike other pandemic favorites, Tiger King, looking at you, I guess in Peloton, too, they have not gone away. A New York Times report found the purchases of the Holy Grail of Holy footwear are up nearly 200%, 200% since 2019. So what gives? Why is the long-favorite shoe of choice of back-of-house restaurant workers now a mainstream staple? Work from home is over, isn't it? And are there any never-crockers left among us? The number is 877-301-8970. Since we're talking about Crocs, will you give me permission to add one thing to the list, which I don't think are exploding like Crocs are? Birkenstocks. I have to say, a lot of people hate Crocs. I would say the foulest shoe wear. And you know what the only thing fouler than a Birkenstock on a foot is?
What?
A Birkenstock on a foot with ankle-length white socks, which is what they do in Cambridge, where I live.
Yeah.
It is foul. So if you want to weigh in any kind of footwear in particular, Crocs are at the top of the list, but Birkenstocks are a close second. Give us a buzz, 877-301-8970. I can see you wearing Crocs. Do you wear Crocs?
No, I don't.
Don't you, when you garden? Isn't that what gardeners
no,
wear?
No, I don't. I do have a pair of clogs.
You do?
I don't have any Crocs.
Okay.
But apparently Generation Z is
that,
all
yeah.
over the Croc
Huge.
Phenomenon. They are yeah. a coveted demographic, of course. That's what retailers want. In the fall, according to this New York Times story, teenagers ranked Crocs number 5 on their list of favorite footwear brands. So there you go. They're very popular. And some people, they do these stories where people have, like, this one woman named Adriana Aline has at least 60 pairs of Crocs, and she's not the only one. I guess people buy, her son has got 20 pairs of Crocs. They talk to all these people that have multiple pairs of Crocs in different colors and different designs, and they say they're very comfortable and they're very good for flat feet. I don't know. I think they're kind of, they're not my, I don't
can
like
I,
them.
Can you explain something to me, even though you don't have them? Maybe you know this. If not, a caller will answer. Is it that they're comfortable, or is it that they're fashionably ugly? I mean, I don't mean that as a joke, by the way. Is that what is appeal, sort of like the offbeat,
I don't know,
unattractive
but
look?
But I've never worn them, but clogs are very comfortable. We see a lot of people, nurses and physicians,
yeah,
wearing
do.
Clogs, right? I've not seen too many of them wearing Crocs.
I don't know if I ever
So
know.
It may, I'm left to deduce that if you were after comfort, you would go with the clog rather than the Croc.
Okay, before we get to the calls and the texts, what do you think about Birkenstocks, Marjorie?
Jim,
do you have strong feelings or don't?
I think that you see them and you think that person is from Cambridge.
No, I mean, you really do.
Isn't that what you
and
think?
And what do you think about the white sock look on with the Birkenstocks?
Yeah, I don't know if you want to wear socks with sandals in general.
Right to your ankle.
It's not a good
no,
look.
So.
If you're gonna get, it's going to be one or the other. Anyway, we're ready to hear your story about your passionate feelings
Can
about Crocs one way or the other. Yes?
I'd like to say something.
Yes.
And I'm fairly proud of this.
Uh-huh.
If you lined up 100 Cantabrigians in a room, and I could not see their feet. I could just talk to them for a second, 10 seconds each. I could identify every single one who's wearing Birkenstocks.
Really?
Like, I could, yeah.
Well, you're surrounded by Birkenstocks over there?
I have Birkenstock DAR, is what I think it is called. 877-301-8970. I know we're supposed to be talking about Crocs, so my apologies.
Okay, Scott on the North Shore, thank you for calling.
Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey there. Thank you for letting me join.
Sure.
I am a longtime listener, first-time caller.
Well, thank you so much.
I think if you like Crocs, there's two things that you have to like. Is you have to be confident in yourself to wear them, period.
Yeah.
And you've got to love what you do, whether that be walking in rocky oceans or gardening or whatever. It's just I wear them out and about everywhere, and I'm a 50-some-year-old male, and I have no qualms with them. And I've got fleece-lined ones, I've got regular ones, and I do not decorate them. But,
okay.
But I'm not there yet. But they're great, and
okay.
You just got to embrace yourself.
Scott, what is up with the fleece-lined ones? Are those to run out on short notice in the wintertime, or what's the deal?
Yeah, I can wear those out to the places out and about in town and feel confident, comfortable that I'm in the winter, and I can still wear no socks.
There you go.
Scott. You know how to live, Scott, I must say. Thank you for your first call. Make another one soon. I really appreciate
they're
it.
They're everywhere. You do notice
I know
them
they
everywhere.
Are.
They're very, very popular. I mean, their stock has gone up hugely. Their sales have gone up hugely. And lots of people seem to think that they're very good if you have flat feet.
How much they cost, Like 50? They're not expensive, right? It's a piece of plastic, isn't it?
You know something?
I think it's
believe,
like 50 bucks or
I can't
or
believe
something.
They left this out of the story. I don't think the price is... Oh, which often sell for $49.99. It's right
really?
Here. $49.99.
That's pretty close
$99.
To $50.
That's cheaper than clogs. Clogs are much more expensive.
Before we continue, Jamie, did you write this note? Okay, here's what it says. It's been rumored a member of our team, meaning someone who works for Boston Public Radio, who lives in Cambridge, has been seen wearing Birkenstocks with socks up to their ankles. Who would that be?
I don't know anybody else who lives in Cambridge besides you.
Well, this is really troubling.
Oh, I think he's giving us a clue.
Oh, I think that's a problem.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Well,
he's
not
a man.
Be here tomorrow, let me tell you that. Good luck to you. You've done pretty good work. Good luck on the next show. Hey, Karen in a car. That is appalling, by the way.
Appalling.
Karen in a car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. What's up?
Hi.
Hey.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
If you said, can you hear me, we can. Hi.
Yes. Okay.
Yep.
All right. So I happen to love Crocs. I have multiple pairs, fleece lined, regular slip-ons. The only issue is I can't wear them in the house because I have a parrot. Her name is Skittles.
Wait, a parrot or a pan?
A parrot.
Oh, a parrot. I'm sorry.
A parrot.
I thought you said a parent.
Her name is Skittles, and if she sees me wearing these Crocs,
what happens?
she dive bombs and starts attacking my
feet. That's a problem. That's a real problem.
Yes.
So
why is that? Yeah.
I have no idea. We have two parrots, and there's certain objects that if I'm holding something, they'll, like, lunge at you. But the crocs are definitely a trigger point for our bird, you know, Skittle. She just does not like them.
Let me tell you what the good news is for you. Even though that's bad, I thought you said I have a parent whose name is Skittles. I would have said that was a real problem. Karen, we're really sorry that you have to suffer like that. But by the way, how old are the parrots?
Fergie is 10 and Skittles is 8.
Now, before you go away, we learned this from Jonathan Gruber and his wife, the guy from our economist friend from MIT. He told us that parrots often live to 80, and generally before you adopt or buy a parrot, you have to agree that there'll be some way to take care of the parrot when you're dead before the parrot is. Is that, did you have to deal with that?
Yes, unfortunately, that is true. Yeah. The parrots that we have will live from like 25 to 30.
Oh.
They're not the huge parrots.
Oh, okay.
But yes, that's a problem. You have to kind of find somebody to take care of them if you pass away before them.
Well, good luck with the parrots and the crocs. Thank you for the call, Kara.
We have a lot of people who feel very passionately about
this.
What
do they say?
Well, one texter says they are ugly as all get out, but perfect dog shoes. Going out in the yard with my pets, easy on, easy off. Julie from Hopedale wearing fuzzy line crocs in a tie-dye pattern. That is great. They're my slippers. Also have other pairs for camping, supportive and comfy, but she agrees that they are ugly.
Did you know that there was such a thing as fuzzy line Crocs till these first two colors?
No, I did not. I kind of like Uggs kind of deal. No. That was one of the great things about Uggs. They had that really soft line, but they were terrible for your feet. Maybe that's why people have switched from Uggs to Crocs, because they supposedly are more supportive. Okay, let's go to Steve and Taunton. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Steve, what's up?
How you doing?
Excellent.
Fine, thanks.
Good. I bought Crocs years ago because I had neuropathy in my feet.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very roomy, and they were very comfortable.
Oh, great.
But they ended up giving me flat feet.
Oh.
So
now I spent $400 on orthotics.
That's a problem.
To fix the bad feet problem. And they charge you $50 for those pieces of crap. And I bought 10 of them at a yard sale for $5 each.
Good for you, Steve. You're a frugal man.
So wait a second. You can't wear orthotics in a croc, right?
Yes, you can.
Oh, I didn't know. Don't they fall out?
No. The crocs are pretty well self-contained. They really encompass your foot.
Oh.
But all they are is just a piece of rubber.
Yeah,
right? They must make them for like 36 cents.
Yeah, I would say it's probably true.
Well, so the people that have texted us to say that crocs are good for flat feet, you would argue that they're incorrect, Steve. Is that right?
No. For crocs, sandals, anything that is flat, like they are, just makes your feet flat.
Okay.
Just press it, your feet go down. So unless you have an arch in there,
So
I spend good money on arch orthotics.
Very good.
Okay, well, we're sorry for you there, Steve. Thanks for the call. I'm really sorry you're suffering.
Now, Jamie says his three-year-old wears fuzzy Crocs every day, loves them, the only shoes he can put on himself, no need to tie. That is a good point. You don't have to worry about tying them or even Velcroing them.
Are you kidding
them.
Me? Why do you think he posted this thing about his three-year-old?
Why?
Because he's worried we're going to focus on the prior post and fire Aiden. That's the only reason that he is... I mean, you don't understand Jamie at all, by the way.
Okay.
He doesn't give a damn about his kid. This is about covering Braden wearing Birkenstocks with white socks.
Okay.
By the way, I have a long memory, you guys, so doesn't matter. The distractions have no effect on me. Let's go to Jeremiah.
Hold on. What? One of the texters says the former Provincetown leather merchant, that would be you, Jim,
that's me, yeah,
is biased against plastic Crocs.
Well, I don't like them.
You don't like them.
By the way, do you like wearing plastic anyway? I mean, or rubber?
I didn't know they were plastic.
Goods? Well, they're rubber or plastic. They're something like that. What do you think they are?
I don't know. I'm not going to buy any. I'm not worrying about it.
You want to go to Jeremiah?
Aiden says it's a good thing he's not taking any fashion cues from the two of us, Jim.
Well, you're not going to be taking anything from the two of us.
I would say
we're
very consistent. I've seen that sweatshirt on you about 9,000 times.
What's the problem?
He's wearing a sweatshirt. Jim is wearing a hoodie sweatshirt.
I am at least
not wearing
a
sweatshirt to work.
Because Starlight, which it says on it, is one of the great things that has ever happened to Cambridge.
Okay.
It's a pop-up theater in Central Square where the nauseating vote of some unelected body by 3-2 was to not license them for this upcoming summer, which is a disgrace.
Okay. It's still a sweatshirt. I have a sweater, same sweater, in about 9 different colors.
Okay.
And I mixed up the colors to be a little bit more
fashion forward. I wouldn't go down this route if I were
you.
Marjorie, how many public events have we gone to together in the 25 years we worked together?
A lot.
Let's say 1,000?
1,000.
How many?
1,000.
Okay.
Maybe
500.
Maybe 150.
Okay, 150.
Okay.
You've worn the same dress
That's
to all 150 of those. Is that, am I being unfair?
That's not true. I have a summer dress and I have a winter dress.
So you've worn two dresses to the 150.
That's right. That's right. I don't want to, I mean, I'm not fashion forward, let's face it.
By the way,
that's
not critical, just factually accurate.
Jeremiah in Fort Haven, thank you for calling.
Hey, Jeremiah.
Fairhaven.
Fairhaven.
Hi, Fairhaven.
No worries.
Yeah, what's going on, Jeremiah?
My wife is a Never Crocker.
Oh.
But she is also a Captain Planet.
So what's that?
I find myself a pair, you know, she thinks everything is sustainable.
Oh, okay.
Good for her.
Okay.
Good for her.
Right.
Yeah.
I love it.
Good.
She had, so I bought a pair of the Crocs at the local thrift shop, and I skirted the law she created about Never Crockers. Anyway, Merrill makes a pair like the Croc that I now wear to kayak. I got the thumbs up on the plastic shoes. And they're comfortable and very utilitarian.
Wow, that's a really beautiful ending to what could have been a troubling story,
Jeremiah. I guess you're right about the environmental front, because we're getting emails from people. Here's one that says, Crocs are the only shoe that will never decompose.
Oh, I see that,
So in our landfills, we will find Barbie dolls and Crocs. And the
that's
world will know how silly Americans are. I did not know that they were indestructible in the landfills. Okay, let's go to, did we just talk to Jeremiah in Fairhaven?
Yeah, bye,
we're moving
Jeremiah.
On.
See you soon.
We are going now to Michael in Revere. Hi, Michael.
Hello, Marjorie. Hi, Jim.
Hey.
So here's my story. I love my Crocs.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
They're like the open-toed kind of sandal kind.
Oh, that's disgusting. Go ahead.
And they still have the little holes. So in the summer, you get, the little
air
tan holes on your feet.
Yeah. Oh,
But I actually love them.
Yeah.
And I've bequeathed them to my children in my will. So
the whole
point is that they will, even though they'll never decompose, they'll always have an
stay
owner.
In the family.
Well, so, they're probably indestructible, I would say, in general. Don't,
you can also pass
time?
On that woman's parrots to your children. You know, Michael, I have to say, open-toed Crocs on guys really doesn't do it for me. What's up with that?
Well, I tried Birkenstocks.
Yeah,
but I have weird shaped feet.
Okay,
could not wear them. They
that.
Hurt
yeah.
me like. Well, hey.
Go ahead.
They hurt me. They hurt me really bad. So the Crocs were the only things that really felt comfortable.
Oh, okay. Well, good.
And they provide good support. They're airy. They're comfortable. You can walk in them.
Yeah. Well, that's good. No, you can
they're great.
So how big a deal? I would not think that Revere would be a hotbed of crocism, is it?
No, I would say not.
No. I think you'd see that more in Cambridge.
Michael, thanks for your call. I'm sure your kids are quite happy. Thank
Andy,
you.
Andy the mailman says,
what's he say?
As one who is repulsed by the sight of the human foot, I'm all for Crocs as opposed to sandals. Please take note of this, Jim. Stop subjecting others to the sight of your talons in the summer months.
By the way, since you didn't ask, what do I wear? I wear handcrafted sandals.
That's right, you do.
By Kim Rouleau, who is the son of Roger Rouleau, the most famous sandal maker, he has passed, in history in Provincetown, who invented, you've complimented these, by the way, the sandal that does not have a buckle. Roger
That's
created
right.
those, I want you to know, and his son has continued the tradition.
I've said nice things about them, Jim, to make you happy, but really, I'm
okay,
with,
don't
I'm with
go.
Andy
I know
the
where you're going.
I am with Andy the mailman.
What'd he say?
Well, he says the human foot, particularly male human feet, are not particularly attractive.
I tell you, there are a lot of foot fetish people in our audience. I'd be kind.
Okay.
Let's leave it at that.
a lot of women who go who look very nice in those little pumps with the toenails polished.
Oh, yeah.
You That's girls pretty good. In their
look
summer
at this
dresses
photo.
And their summer feet.
So foul.
Is that Aiden?
I hope no. Crocs is okay. I hope it's on. We're
right.
almost done here.
Thank you very much for Thank tuning you. In today. Thank you for people that came down to the Boston
Thank
Public
Library.
Thank you
all for coming. We
very
appreciate
much. It. And keep up with this 24/7 Boy Ever podcast. Tomorrow we're going to be joined by Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's been going toe-to-toe in this banking crisis with the head of the Fed, Jerome Powell, Harvard National Security expert Juliet Kayyem, our medical ethicist Art Kaplan, and Boston Globe travel writer Christopher Muther, plus National Cy Montgomery. Got a great show tomorrow. I want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aiden Conley, despite the Crocs, Nicole Garcia, Hannah Loss. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Brian Bell was on the boards for us today. And our executive producer, Jenny Bologna, plus our BPL staff, Evelyn Brito, Angelica Marrero, and Steve Baracci. Jim, good luck to you in your Birkenstocks.
Can I just say, I don't have Birkenstocks. Judge says Pence must testify in January 6th grand jury. Such fabulous news. I'm Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. Thank you again for tuning in today.
Thank
Hope you
all.
Can tune in tomorrow. Meanwhile, have a great afternoon.